Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Also, allow me to apologize to other families formed through transracial adoption, because I am deeply sorry that we suggested that interracial families are in any way funny or deserving of ridicule.
There are many paths to parenthood, and every year thousands of Americans choose the route of adoption. But when Nefertiti Austin, a single black woman, chose to adopt, she ran into a host of systemic and cultural barriers. Though she was able to bring home a baby boy, which she named August, she says she faced continual questions about her ability to raise a black son. Austin explores all of this in her new book, Motherhood So White, a memoir of race, gender, and parenting in America. Nefertiti, thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Before we get started, let's talk about your story and your genesis for deciding to adopt. So it was 2006. You were a single woman, a writer living in L.A., Beverly Hills.
Yes.
When you made this conscious decision to formally adopt instead of having a biological child, what were some of the reasons why?
Well, I was raised by my grandparents, and I think having that experience of being raised by people who had not given birth to me kind of set me on a path to, well, if someone could do that for me, I could do that for someone else. And my best friend is adopted. She's also an adoption social worker. So for years, I had been hearing about all of these children who needed homes. And it had been in the back of my mind for a while. And I wanted to be married, and I wanted to have a family the traditional route. But I was very open to wanting to adopt. And I felt that that was really important to give back and to do that first.
And you found this in your journey to coming to a formal adoption. So you decided to adopt. You received lots of mixed responses from family and friends.
Yes.
You say in the book, quote, adopting a child, I did not know I was breaking the code.
Yes.
What exactly is the code?
Well, essentially, black people tend to adopt people we know. So we are seeking a point of reference. We adopt within our families. So typically we start there. Nieces, nephews, cousins, extended family members. We have a very large Christian faith in our community that's very important to us. So if a church member has a niece or nephew who's got a child who needs assistance, we want to step up and help. And so typically that is the path that we pursue, as opposed to going outside of your family, going outside of your known community to become a parent.
You also write, not only did white people believe it, nonsense the media spread about kids, specifically in the foster care system, black people did too. So that played a role as well in choosing children that you knew that were a known quantity.
Absolutely. Because when you know the family, you know the father or the mother's had some challenges, for some reason we either give it a pass or we figure, okay, I can deal with that. I know what that's about. But it's a whole nother dynamic when you give in to rumors and myths and lies, really, about the children, that they're damaged, they're crack babies, they are going to grow up and become these domestic terrorists within society. The prevailing narrative is that there's something wrong with the system, therefore there is something wrong with these children.
Once you were able to adopt your son, you went out, you were searching for books and mommy groups and those types of things, and you didn't find books that
really spoke to what you wanted. Can you explain a little bit about what you went to look for and what you found and why the distinction is important to you in finding books specific to your experience as a Black mother?
Well, before I actually started the process and I knew I was ready to do so, my go-to is information always. Mm-hmm. So I'm on the internet, I'm at the library. And so even before I had finished the process, I realized, wow, I don't see myself in any of these pages. The Mommy Wars were really popular at that point. And I'm like, well, I have nothing to contribute to that conversation. And it began to crystallize, especially once August came home, that there were no narratives for a single Black woman who had adopted. Mm. And it infuriated me that whenever a white starlet adopted a child, it was like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is so great. And there were all of these people who were doing that on a daily basis, and especially women who look like me. And we were just erased from the conversation. We didn't exist even within the adoption community. So it was important to me because there was a distinction. I didn't make the distinction. Yeah. I just kind of walked into the distinction and learned that I was in the margins.
Let's talk a little bit more about those distinctions, because uh-huh. I know a lot of folks listening might be thinking, well, isn't the act of mothering a race-neutral act?
It could be race-neutral, but when Trayvon Martin is murdered by a vigilante in the street and Tamir Rice is murdered for playing with a toy gun, it's political, it's racial, and it has been, I mean, for hundreds of years at this particular point. And if Black mothers could just parent and not be worried about their child having a Nerf gun fight on the front lawn and could securely feel that, oh, yeah, my child can do what Jacob does or what Johnny does, then it would be race neutral. Mm-hmm. But of course, we know that that is definitely not the case. Our kids are perceived as behavior problems. They are considered aggressive, but their white counterpart is considered rambunctious. And our girls are sexualized at an early age. They are thought to have attitudes. But if another girl, a white girl, says the same thing or responds in like manner, it's, oh, well, she was annoyed, or it's excused. Mm-hmm. And so many of our actions have a negative attachment to it. That isn't our doing. Mm-hmm. And so then we're stuck with having to explain, well, this is how the person was feeling, or this is why they responded in the way. It's like, I feel like we spend so much time explaining, oh, this is how I felt, this is what I was thinking, because it is assumed that I'm coming from a negative place just because my skin is Black.
As part of your book, you talk a lot about the myth of Black male hypermasculinity.
Right.
It's something that you're hyper aware of.
My grandfather was very stoic, and so his idea of affection was a pat on the back. So when my son was 3 or 4, we were visiting my grandparents, and I'm telling him, oh, handshake and a hug. And my grandfather very formally said, men do not hug. And I thought, oh my God, here we go. We're going to start this emotional distance within our family, within our community. Again, here's another generation of that about to happen. And it's extremely problematic. I mean, there's so many men who are taught to hold their emotions in check. Yeah. And I think that all of that, it bottles up. Mm-hmm. And at some point,
and it becomes toxic.
Very toxic. It makes people sick. People die young. And it definitely hampers relationships between men and women. And that camaraderie that boys need with other boys is, damage isn't the right word, but maybe they can't really reach that emotional intimacy that women have, that girls have with each other, where they could really talk about, it hurt my feelings when, mm-hmm. and someone else can say, you know what, I had that same experience, you're not alone, and let's see how we can work through this together.
Raising a son as a Black mother, you received all sorts of advice. You actually have this story in your book where you were mansplained while getting your son August a haircut. What do these interactions say? And in many ways, we think that they're just trying to help. Mm-hmm. But also, you think it says something bigger.
Yes.
About the perception of you as a single Black woman raising a son.
Yes. Sometimes the comments I felt either stemmed from their fears about oh, wow, you've got this child and you're by yourself, and or you have a child and you don't know anything about his people. That was a big one. And, you know,
meaning his birth family.
His birth family. So, you know, good luck with that. Or, okay, you need to make sure that he gets his hair cut every 2 weeks, as if that somehow will improve his character if his hair is not cut every 2 weeks like clockwork. So it's funny.
Yeah. At the end of your book, you have profiles of other Black women who have chosen to adopt. What is your message to other Black mothers out there who may be listening, who are thinking about taking on this journey of adopting a Black child?
Well, I definitely hope that anyone thinking about it will know that it can absolutely be done. I mean, I've gone from free-spirited person to I'm actually a planner. I feel like a real grown-up now. And certainly if I can do it, any other Black woman considering it can do it, should do it, and not rely on or get caught up in what other people say. Because I think we still have a lot of fear in our community about raising children and what they think and how they perceive us. And I think that if we have narratives about people who look like us, that it just gives, I think, more power behind that decision that we want to make.
Nefertiti Austin, author of Motherhood So White, a memoir of race, gender, and parenting in America. Nefertiti, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we have an excerpt of the book at hereandnow.org.
But if I was white, then I'd be better off. Isn't that true?
Schools are increasingly vowing to root out racism in the education system, but people of color say much more needs to be done. A new book by a high school senior in the Seattle district offers a candid account of how it felt to be on the receiving end of that racism. Azure Savage is the author of You Failed Us, Students of Color Talk Seattle Schools. Savage is a trans guy who uses he, him pronouns. He has a Black father and a white mother and entered the district's gifted program known as the Highly Capable Cohort in first grade. Savage told KNKX Youth and Education reporter Ashley Gross that he did not want to switch schools after testing into the program, which has been criticized for its lack of racial diversity.
I was not happy about the transfer. I mean, I made friends. Like, I've always been a social person. I feel like people have the misconception that I'm writing this because I had no friends and I was really lonely. That wasn't my case, honestly. I had no Black friends.
So you had white friends?
I had white friends. I had one Black friend my first grade year and second grade year, and then she left the school. And then there was no Black girls in my program for third and fourth grade. And then fifth grade, another one came and transferred in the program. And I mean, I immediately was like, hey, let's be friends.
And you describe how being in this kind of segregated program really impacted your identity. In what way did it impact your identity?
I would say that it made me hate who I was for many, many years. It made me question my worth as a person. And not even question, but it made me believe that I didn't have worth as a person if I wasn't accepted by white people. I never felt fully set anywhere because I was always like fighting to be accepted.
And at the same time, you had this like real desire to have Black friends, but mm-hmm. you didn't have access to them. Like, you didn't have interaction with them, right?
At my school, there was the Black program at my elementary school.
A Black program?
Okay, not the Black. Okay, that's not what it's actually called. The general program, which just happens to be only Black students. In my eyes, as a young person, it was the Black program. And I saw all these Black students at my school, and I didn't know how to reach them. Maybe if I was less introverted, I could have gone up and like talked to them and initiated a conversation. But again, that fear of rejection came up then too, not just with the white students, but being scared of being rejected by the Black students for being with the white students.
Seattle Public Schools is evaluating now what to do with the Highly Capable program and the future of how the program will be structured. You write that you feel like it should just be dismantled. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. And what I've kind of concluded, and also just analyzing the way it kind of works and the how much it affects students, whether they're in the HCC program or the general program, it gives HSC students a sense of entitlement and a sense of superiority. And the general students I've talked to have shared feeling dumb their whole lives and feeling like they were less important. And I don't think either of those are okay. It's not okay for kids to grow up feeling entitled, feeling superior. And it's also very wrong for kids to feel like they're not worth anything. And more than just that aspect of it, the opportunities involved. I mean, the whole idea of tracking, it's a fact that HCC students are just put at a higher level right away, and they retain that higher level. And it's very hard for a general student to get up to that level. And I've received a lot of backlash, I guess, from people who really do believe in the general, in the HCC program, who really think it's necessary. And I'm genuinely confused how someone could look at the racial makeup of each of them and say, this isn't racist. I honestly think it would have been better for me to not have been in that program. I don't think it impacted me in a positive way. And I don't think that even though I got to learn at a faster rate or anything, it was worth it.
Sometimes when I think about the school system, it seems like it's designed to groom kids for entering like white workplaces mm-hmm. and white society.
Yeah.
And so I wonder what your thoughts are on creating a school system that really does help students feel proud of their identity and culture, while at the same time preparing them to enter that world
right.
that is also, you know, has institutional yeah. racism.
I would say that one of the biggest ways to prepare students for that is to have discussions about it, to talk about it in classes, to be transparent with the students that the society within the United States has a lot of racism in it. And I think that, honestly, that's not something that people of color really need to be told. It's kind of something that we learn from living and experiencing. But having those discussions and, like, brainstorming, strategizing for how to work through that, building skills on how to confront people when they're being racist, how to advocate for yourself, that was something I had to learn outside of my education.
Because you felt like those conversations weren't happening
no.
in class?
The only time we've really ever talked about race was in history classes when we're talking about slavery or talking about the indigenous people's genocide. And I think that those two events are the backbone for a lot of the racism within this society. However, it's not enough to just talk about those events because there's a lot of current racism that's stemming from systems in place from centuries ago. I feel like schools can move toward being institutions that prepare students not just to move into that society, but prepare them to know how to change it, know how to make the changes that they are able to within it, and work to create this society to serve everyone within it.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah.
Azure Savage is the author of the new book, You Failed Us, Students of Color Talk Seattle Schools. He's 17 years old and a high school senior in the Running Start program. Ashley Gross, KNKX News.
There's a launch party for Azure Savage's book tomorrow evening at 7 at the Prudential Building in Seattle. To be a man, gifted
and black. Parents in East Texas say the school board in their area actually changed the dress code to discriminate against little black boys. Randy Woodley says the Tatum Independent School Superintendent had a problem with her grandson's long hair. Look at that cutie. Mm-hmm. His hair is long. And this is what she says. She says, he told me that I could either cut it, braid it, and pin it up, or put my grandson in a dress and send him to school. And when prompted, my grandson must say he's a girl. The dress code states no ponytails, ducktails, rat tails, male buns, or puffballs are allowed on male students. dress code continues to write that hair for a male should not extend past the top of a t-shirt collar. Now, with the no ponytails, another parent is worried because her son has dreads, and she's worried that she won't be able to put them in a ponytail to keep the hair out of his face. And as you can see, we're talking about very, very young kids. And but as Woodley points out, you know, we shouldn't even be talking about this at any age because hair has nothing to do with learning.
That's absolutely right.
And Tatum ISD administrators told local news reporters that they have no comment at this time.
I bet they don't. They're going to have some comments once this story goes viral and those people start making sure that administrators get fired. That whoever wrote that code sounds like they're they're riddled with toxicity.
Yep.
Because, you know, to implicate that a child wants to be a girl, because there are like people that I know, personal friends of mine who are Polynesian, and their children have long hair for cultural reasons.
Right.
And sometimes it's ritualistic and it could be religious. And it's just, Orthodox Jews grow their hair out this way and it's long. And sometimes who gets to tell people, how you define masculinity or manhood or your gender? That little boy can identify whatever he like, because that's his right. My bigger problem is this has been coming on along the white people proud of cutting people's dreadlocks out off people who are Rastafari.
Wait, what?
Yes. Yeah, that was the proud white people who get to cut the people's locks, locks off, and you know, like they're aiding these white people. It's like the Aborigines and the rabbit fence in Australia. Like, they took all of those children of color and they put them in white families and they made them assimilate. And it's really part of the plan that they're targeting us, people of color. And it's all of this is connected, whether you want to believe it or not. The babies in the cages and cutting the dreadlocks and castrating, the blackness and taking away the things that we're culturally proud of. And it's really sickening. And I really feel that parents should stand up for their children.
Absolutely. I look at this and I see this as being a reflection of gender policing and essentially saying you have to adhere to these traditional norms of what a girl would look like or traditional norms of what a boy would look like. And of course, it has racial implications as a result of that because of who and what culture decides to engage in what hairstyle, look, appearance. And it's all just trying to erase otherness of individuals who have different skin tones, of different looks, different cultures, and to make them, as Ida pointed out, assimilate to a larger white culture. And that's not okay. People should be able to wear what they want, look how they want. And just the whole gender policing thing, what is the threat to you with hair? It's not a matter of safety as it is in certain professions or jobs where you can't necessarily have your hair out. This is a matter of kids going to school. Like the parent said, it has nothing to do with learning.
You know, it's not like people of color are forcing white girls to go get injections in their butts and
or
their lips or making them go get tans and saying, this is melanin is magic. You have to look like us. Y'all chose to do that too. So it's like, it's not okay. It's not okay to get to pick what's in all the time. And you get to switch it around. When I was modeling, having a big butt was a no-no.
Yeah.
Being hippie was a no-no. I developed an eating disorder trying to adhere to a standard that was impossible for me. And then now it's like, oh, you know what? Now everybody's trying to do the butts. My message beyond all of this is to people of color is melanin is magic and it is divine. And don't let anybody talk you out of how beautiful it is. Because if it wasn't that beautiful, they would not try to emulate it at every turn.
I agree. Mm-hmm. We have so many of these stories that happen so much. It's like policing things that are culturally black.
Yeah.
Hair. Little girls can't wear braids to school or certain styles. Little boys can't wear certain hairstyles. Little girls can't have certain barrettes in their hair. The swimmer the other day with the different body type. Mm-hmm. How Serena Williams is constantly treated.
We're going to turn now to the ongoing debate around reparations. In recent years, a number of universities have tried to confront how slavery shaped their institutions. Now, Virginia Theological Seminary is doing the same. The seminary, which is just outside Washington, D.C., announced a plan to create a $1.7 million fund for the descendants of the slaves that helped build the school. We wanted to learn more about that plan and what went into the decision, so we've called on Ian Markham. He's an Episcopal priest and the dean and president of Virginia Theological Seminary. Thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
So what led to the creation of this reparations fund?
So we're on the cusp of our 200th birthday. And as you do the work of thinking about that milestone, you find yourself reflecting on 200 years. And we're very conscious that the story is one full of both grace and sin. And we need to recognize that sin is part of that story. And a huge part of that story are enslaved persons who built many of the key buildings on the campus. And almost all the faculty for decades had enslaved persons working for them. So we felt it was important that you can't mark an anniversary of such significance without really thinking through how we're going to relate to that complex part of our history.
And what kind of impact are you hoping that those dollars will have?
The endowment generated approximately $70,000, but it'll be an endowment. So in perpetuity, we can do this work over generations to come. And we hope as a result, we will be building connection. We will be identifying the forebears, people living now who played a significant role, but names have been forgotten. And we've not honored them hitherto. So we hope it's going to be a holistic, relationship-building, healing moment of recognition for the service they've done and the differences they've made.
Do you think more seminaries and religious institutions should follow your lead and find a way to pay reparations for their involvement in slavery?
I think in the end, no institution of faith can avoid the implication that an apology is insufficient. When you've wronged somebody, you don't just say sorry, but you seek to make some sort of amends. And therefore, apology is good, promising to be different in the future is good, but you've got to do something to rectify the damage you've done in the past. And I think faith-based institutions know that that's true, and you have no choice but to do it.
Now, data from the Pew Research Center suggests that the Episcopal Church is overwhelmingly white, about 90%, only about 4% black. Do you think this decision will help in any way toward diversifying congregations, and is that a goal?
Undoubtedly, it's a goal. Changing demographics of America is a course that's absolute and sure and certain. America is changing, and therefore the Episcopal Church to survive has got to be ready and able to change. So yes, a recognition, we're one of the oldest denominations in the United States. We're very fortunate in many, many ways, but we've fully and totally participated in sinful structures. And I think persons of color recognize that, know that, and are interested in how we as historic, primarily white denomination respond to the changing demographics of America and come to terms with our past. So yes, we do hope it'll make a difference.
That's the very Reverend Ian Markham. He's an Episcopal priest and the Dean and President of Virginia Theological Seminary. Thank you so much.
It's been an honor to be here.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon, and I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
I was extremely shocked and disappointed when I learned of Justin Trudeau's actions this evening. Wearing brown face is an act of open mockery and racism. It was just as racist in 2001 as it is in 2019. And what Canadians saw this evening is someone with a complete lack of judgment and someone who's not fit to govern this country.
The nature of the photo is that had it been a different candidate, the Liberal Party would be now saying you have to step down. But obviously this is a very different circumstance. It's their leader.
The kids that see this image, the people that see this image, are going to think about all the times in their life that they were made fun of, that they were hurt, that they were made to feel less because of who they are. I want to talk to all the kids out there, all the folks that live this and now are grown up and are still feeling the pain of racism. You might feel like giving up on Canada. You might feel like giving up on yourselves. I want you to know that you have value, you have worth, and you are loved. And I don't want you to give up on Canada, and please don't give up on yourselves.
That was NDP leader Jagmeet Singh, and before that, Green Party leader Elizabeth May, and of course, Conservative leader Andrew Scheer, reacting to news last night about the 2001 high school yearbook photo of Justin Trudeau, who was a teacher there at the time, dressed as Aladdin and covered in brown face makeup. Tom Perry is a senior reporter with the CBC who has been traveling on the Liberal leader's campaign plane. We reached him in Winnipeg. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Can you describe the atmosphere on the plane yesterday?
I'll start by describing the atmosphere on the bus. We'd just come from a rally in Truro, Nova Scotia. We were driving to the Halifax airport, and that's when this story broke, and it was just pandemonium on the bus, trying to find out whether we're going to be hearing. We've got to hear from Justin Trudeau. So we got to the airport. We all got on board the plane. We were told by Liberal officials, okay, he's going to speak. We got up to the front of the plane, or around the midpoint of the plane. There's a curtain that separates the front of the plane where Justin Trudeau was sitting. We're all waiting there, reporters, cameras, microphones, and finally Justin Trudeau emerges. And he begins, well, as you heard in that tape, this series of apologies, just begging forgiveness from Canadians, or asking forgiveness. I don't think begging forgiveness. Asking forgiveness from Canadians for what he did, saying that he didn't think it was racist at the time, but he certainly realizes it's racist now. And I think it was just a sense of almost disbelief amongst the people on the plane. Like, what's happening here? We just couldn't believe that this was actually going on, but it was. And now Justin Trudeau's dealing with the fallout.
And also during that news conference, he admitted that it had happened before.
Yeah, that's right. My colleague David Cochrane asked him, were there other incidents where you'd worn blackface before? And he said there was, which I think made it seem even more bizarre. He talked about this case when he was in high school, where he dressed up and did Deo. A song, and actually a photograph has emerged from of that now. So you have to think that Justin Trudeau knew this photograph existed, and that's why he was admitting to this at this point. Now, there were a lot of tough questions for Justin Trudeau. The Conservatives have been saying about him, you know, he's not as advertised. And one of the questions was, well, how do you now say to people that's not true? And he just kept apologizing, saying that he realizes that he was that this was wrong. And I guess he's going to have to wait and see whether voters are willing to forgive this incredible misstep going back to 2001. And still elect him their prime minister.
One of the things I heard you pressing him on was when did he know that this story was going to come out? Did you get any sense of how much advance warning that he had?
Well, I think that he probably found out that this was going to drop in the last couple of days. The question that I asked him was, I said, you've known about this since you were 29 years old. So when did you tell the people around you? And I eventually got an answer out of him saying, well, this was just recently. So from that, I take he's been sitting on this since he was 29 years old, maybe hoping it wasn't going to come out. Now that it did come out, he's got to deal with it. And one of the other reporters there was asking that, well, you know, you've got people of color in your government, in your cabinet. What are you doing? And he said, well, I'm going to reach out to them. I'm going to be talking to them. So he's going to be trying to make amends with these people who, you know, maybe I think this might be a little offensive, maybe not in type with Mr. Trudeau. He's got to build fences with the team around him. And he's, of course, got to build mend fences with Canadian voters.
It's also about him calling out other campaigns and other candidates for their missteps on social media. Is he in a position to do that anymore?
I don't know. You know, it's funny because going to that moment last night, you would think that the Conservatives were having a more difficult week than Justin Trudeau. The Liberals had been digging up old social media posts, questionable friendships, things like that. Just a day or so before, when Maxime Bernier from the People's Party of Canada was announced that he was going to be getting into the debates, Justin Trudeau said, well, I look forward to debating Mr. Bernier on and call it his intolerance. I don't know how he's going to do that now. I don't know how that the Liberals, if they've got more opposition research on Conservative candidates, they either have to put that away. Well, I don't know how they come out and start pointing fingers at other people now that their leader has, you know, these photographs have emerged. It's going to be very difficult for them to say you're intolerant when they've got these photos going back of Justin Trudeau.
So have you got any sense yet, Tom, and you may not, of how the Trudeau campaign is going to shift its agenda today?
No. We got into Winnipeg last night. As I said, we did that news conference. We had some time to file The plane took off. We flew to Manitoba. We're at a hotel now. I don't think Justin Trudeau was not at the same hotel. We're waiting for word from the Liberals about what's going to happen today. There was supposed to be a campaign event. We've been told, we were told last night, probably nothing. We're not going to hear anything before 11 o'clock Manitoba time this morning. What's going to happen? Hard to know. You've got to think that it's going to be very difficult for Justin Trudeau to just try to carry on as if nothing happened. Every question he's going to get today, maybe in the coming days, is going to be about this. So I don't know this. I've not heard anything. There's been no emails, no contact from the Liberal campaign this morning to say this is what's going on. But you've got to think that they're rethinking, at least today, maybe rethinking the rest of the campaign. How are they going to deal with this today and in the coming weeks?
Tom, you've covered a lot of campaigns. Can you recall a revelation like this in past campaigns?
You know, we were on the plane last night after we'd taken off, and all of us were talking about this. You know, I've covered a few federal elections, I've covered provincial elections, referendum, and honestly, I can't think of anything. I can't think of anything like this. The closest I can think of, and this is still miles apart from this, was I remember when Belinda Stronach crossed the floor to join Paul Martin's government. I was outside the news conference, saw her getting out of the limousine, and ooh, it was shocking. But not as shocking as this. This is just so out of... When you think about Mr. Trudeau's brand, when you think about what he is, what he portrays himself as a politician, you know, inclusiveness, multiculturalism, the whole thing, this is just so out of step that I've never seen anything like this in my time covering, provincial or federal politics.
All right, Tom, thanks so much for talking to us this morning. We'll pay attention to your reports today.
That's what Hitler was doing, in World War II. So you got a parallel. In other words, you got a base from which to work, a legal base. First of all, you say it's racist, because that's what they executed these people about. Hermann Göring and all these people went on trial in the 1940s for war crimes, heinous crimes, getting rid of people by the use of poison. Now, that's what the racists are doing. And disease, okay? Then once you convict them, automatic execution. And I'm asking the white people to ask their legislators to say that's what we want. See, with a machine gun and say you're cleaning up the drug problem, see, you are running a game on us. That's somebody's son that you have roped in. See, what do you think this is? We can see through that. See, stop it where it started. We didn't know what the stuff was till you put it in my hand. Still don't know what it is.
Nearly a quarter million Americans have died so far from prescription drug overdoses. Purdue Pharma and other drug companies face thousands of civil lawsuits stemming from the nation's opioid epidemic. Now some lawmakers are asking why more drug industry executives and company owners aren't facing criminal trials and possible jail time for their role in the addiction crisis. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports.
When Purdue Pharma and its owners, members of the Sackler family, declared bankruptcy this week, offering to pay billions of dollars to communities hit by the addiction crisis, Congressman Max Rose, a Democrat from Staten Island, New York, reacted angrily.
The Sackler family does not belong in bankruptcy court. They belong in handcuffs.
Over the last year, civil trials around the country revealed evidence Purdue Pharma and the Sacklers pushed aggressively to sell more highly addictive OxyContin while downplaying the risk of addiction and overdose. Rose says it's time for prosecutors to start treating drug companies as criminal enterprises.
I want the Sackler family charged as criminal drug dealers.
State and federal officials have known for more than a decade drug makers, distributors, and pharmacy chains were playing an outsized role in this epidemic. A review by NPR found dozens of administrative actions where companies were ordered to stop distributing opioids in ways the federal government considered improper. There have also been settlements against drug firms involving criminal as well as civil charges. But none of those plea deals involved jail time. Senator Maggie Hassan, a Democrat from New Hampshire, has called for hearings to investigate why the Justice Department hasn't put more executives on trial.
I think that's exactly the reason we need to see this 2006 memo.
Hassan is demanding the Justice Department give her office a full copy of a 2006 prosecution memo, parts of which appeared in the New York Times last year. The Justice Department has declined to confirm the existence of this document, but Hassan says she believes it will show that some federal attorneys wanted more serious criminal charges filed against Purdue Pharma.
At the 11th hour, top political appointees at the Department of Justice blocked those indictments, and as a result, a much weaker set of plea agreements was entered into with these Purdue executives. They really amounted to a slap in the wrist.
In that 2007 plea deal, four Purdue executives pleaded guilty to misdemeanor charges and agreed to perform community service. In a letter sent to Hassan and to Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, the Justice Department refused to release information about its decision-making in the case, citing long-standing policy against such disclosures. The Justice Department has also declined to speak with NPR about possible criminal prosecutions involving Purdue Pharma. Hassan says if prosecutors had been more aggressive in charging executives, the opioid epidemic might have been curtailed a decade ago.
The trajectory of this crisis might have been different, and we might have saved a lot of lives.
Experts interviewed by NPR offered different explanations for why state and federal prosecutors haven't brought more criminal charges against companies and executives. Michael Canty, a former federal prosecutor, says criminal cases are just far more difficult to win.
You know, one of the basic tenets of being a prosecutor is that you don't bring a case unless you believe you can prove a defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
But Rick Cantwell with the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen thinks there's another reason. Drug companies have large law firms on their side with well-connected attorneys negotiating plea deals.
When the Justice Department is pursuing cases against companies, the people on the other side that they're negotiating with are all too often former federal prosecutors. Right now, it's the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, Mary Jo White, who's representing the Sacklers.
Purdue Pharma and the Sacklers have also been represented in past negotiations with the Justice Department by Rudy Giuliani, himself a former federal prosecutor. But there are signs the drug industry is now facing more scrutiny by criminal investigators.
News out of Boston federal court tonight. The founder of a drug company was just found guilty in a scheme to bribe doctors to prescribe a powerful opioid. It took a jury 15 days to...
In May, five executives with Insys Therapeutics were found guilty on racketeering and conspiracy charges. The Justice Department acknowledged that nearly two decades after the opioid epidemic began, this case marked the first successful prosecution of top drug company executives. At least one other criminal case is now in the works. The Justice Department filed opioid-related charges this spring against Rochester Drug Cooperative, one of the country's largest pharmaceutical distributors, accusing two senior executives of conspiracy and fraud. Brian Mann, NPR News.
Big pharma, big money equals no blame. In recent days, we've heard of settlements and civil suits involving big pharmaceutical companies, the very sources of opioid products like OxyContin, for example, that has left tens of thousands of people gripped in the hold of addiction. Similarly, these products have led to tens of thousands of deaths, some 70,000 people annually, according to some reports. No man or woman on death row has come even remotely close to this tally. And no corporate execs, no matter his legal liability, has come even close to such a fate. This is especially vexing when we consider the ravages of the drug war, which has fueled mass incarceration for decades. Young men wearing hoodies and baseball caps turned backwards, engaged in retail sales of untaxed drugs in the ghettos and tenement streets of America. For this, they were attacked by police and federal agents with all the ferocity of war. In fact, it was a war. And people were treated like enemies of the state and cast into prison for decades at least. Enter Big Pharma, who launched drugs upon America on an industrial scale and made billions to boot. Consider this simple fact. In 1 year, more Americans have died from corporate opioid products than the number of Americans who died in Vietnam after 10 years of war. For retail sellers of drugs, decades in prison await. For corporate wholesale drug merchants, civil suits are the state's responses. Since when is the killing of thousands of people a civil tort? When we witness the parameters of the drug war, we see it had nothing to do with drugs and everything to do with state repression of the people, those people from the ghettos and barrios of America, from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The man knot, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Last month in Lake County, Illinois, just north of Chicago, six teenagers allegedly tried to break into a car. The owner shot and killed one of them, a 14-year-old boy. The story has garnered a lot of press in Illinois, not just because of the tragedy, but because the five other teens were all charged with the boy's murder. How could this be? NewsHour Weekend's Megan Thompson takes a look at the little-known legal statute behind the case. A warning, this story contains images some viewers might find disturbing.
On the morning of February 23, 2015, five teenagers drove to the end of a quiet street in Millbrook, Alabama, about 10 miles north of Montgomery. The teens, who were armed, broke into an empty house, stealing electronics and money, then went up the block to another empty home. A suspicious neighbor called 911.
Well, I think we got them blocked off right now if you're still there.
Two Millbrook police officers soon arrived. One went in the front, the other along the side. Gunfire broke out. As the second officer ran towards the backyard, one of the teens, 16-year-old Adante Washington, came through a back gate carrying a gun. The officer hit Washington three times. He died at the scene. Andre Washington is Adante's father.
Good son, good child.
Washington remembers his son as a quiet kid who dreamed of playing football for the University of Florida.
Full of energy when he was young, just full of energy. After high school, he wanted to go to like the Florida Gators.
As the shock of his son's death sunk in, Washington learned something else shocking. Though none had pulled the trigger, the four other teens at the house were all being charged not just with burglary and theft, but with murder, the murder of Adante Washington.
It's crazy.
Do you think the other boys are responsible for Adante's death?
No.
In Alabama, a murder conviction can bring a sentence of up to 99 years. Three of the teens took plea deals. The fourth, Lakeith Smith, was offered 25 years, but he rejected it and took his case to court. C.J. Robinson is the chief deputy district attorney for Alabama's 19th Circuit.
He didn't pull the trigger. He didn't kill anybody. So how can he possibly be charged with murder?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, to answer that question, you really have to look at Alabama law. When you look at how that law is on the books and how it's applied in Alabama, it goes to the foreseeable factor, all right?
In Alabama, the law says all suspects can be charged with murder if a death occurs during a felony that's clearly dangerous to human life. Another legal standard used is that the death was foreseeable.
Do I think when I break into this house, an officer is going to come running in and we're going to get in a gunfight? Is that foreseeable? Yes.
Robinson also based his decision on the fact that the group was charged in other crimes in Montgomery in the 36 hours before Washington was killed. One defendant pled guilty to murder. Charges of kidnapping and robbery are still pending against Lakeith Smith.
When you're engaging in a series of the most dangerous behavior that's out there, the question for us was, is it foreseeable that someone could die based off these five young men's conduct? Our answer was absolutely.
Alabama's law is based on something called the felony murder rule, a centuries-old legal concept. Stephen Drizin is a clinical professor at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law.
So in its purest form, the felony murder rule means that if you commit a felony and during the course of that felony somebody dies, you can be convicted of first-degree murder, the most serious crime on our statute books, even if you didn't intend to kill the person who died, even if the death was accidental.
42 states have some form of a felony murder rule, and it's interpreted differently in each. In some cases, it's been used to charge accomplices with murder. So, for instance, if two people rob a store and one of them kills the clerk, both of them are charged with murder. The idea is everyone involved in a felony should be held accountable for the consequences. But some states interpret felony murder more broadly. In rare cases, if the clerk kills one of the robbers, the other robber is charged with murder. Take the case of Justin Doyle in Illinois. In 2008, Doyle, 15 and unarmed, set out to rob a home with three other boys. They thought it was empty. A person staying there shot and killed one teen, Travis Castle. The other three were charged with Castle's murder. Faced with a possible 60-year sentence, Doyle, who got a tattoo to memorialize Castle, pled guilty to home invasion and involuntary manslaughter and was likely to get out of prison in 15 years. Stephen Drizin got Doyle's sentence commuted by the Illinois governor.
Most people are offended by the notion that teenagers who want to commit a burglary can be charged with felony murder or first-degree murder. The punishment is just much too harsh for the criminal culpability.
I want to ask you about why this is an appropriate tool to use. If you are out to commit a crime, whatever it may be, you should pay for whatever consequences arise.
The answer to that argument is you punish the burglar with the higher range of sentences for the burglary. You don't punish someone for crimes they neither intended or committed.
Back in Alabama, even though Lakeith Smith was 15 at the time of the shootings, he was tried in adult court. Brontina Smith is Lakeith's mother.
Your son was offered a deal.
He was.
Plea deal. He did not take it.
Did not.
Why not?
That was my son's thing. He was like, I didn't kill anybody. Like, why am I admitting to a murder that I know I didn't commit? The cop killed him.
That cop was cleared of wrongdoing. Lakeith Smith's trial took place in 2018 in rural Elmore County, north of Montgomery. An all-white jury found him guilty of burglary, theft, and murder.
You just don't get it, do you?
And the judge, annoyed at what he claimed was Smith's disrespectful demeanor, sentenced him to 65 years in prison.
What went through your head when you heard 65 years?
It was malice. It's like, if you don't do what they want you to do, I'm going to show you.
He did commit a crime.
He did. And he should have got the proper time for the crime that he committed, the burglary and the stolen property. So 65 years, I'm a young guy, 15, who didn't kill no one. Didn't kill no one and didn't shoot at no one. Alabama.
What do you say to critics of this? They say we shouldn't be charging, bringing this charge in situations like that. What do you say?
I understand people who may not understand the law or may want the law to be different. You know, if the Supreme Court says it's got to be this way, then I will gladly apply the law that way.
Back in Illinois, an investigation in 2016 by the Chicago Reader found 10 cases over the previous 5 years of killings by law enforcement that led to felony murder charges. One case was that of Tevin Lewis.
Pull in over here so you can see.
Femi Soyode was Tevin Lewis's attorney. In 2012, when Lewis was 19, he and Marquise Sampson, his close friend since childhood, robbed a sandwich shop on Chicago's South Side.
Mr. Sampson came out of King Giro and literally ran across the street. And coincidentally, an officer just happened to see him running across the street holding his waistband. And officer just, boom, started chasing him all throughout these neighborhoods right over here. Mr. Lewis went the opposite way. this way, southbound.
The officer shot and killed Sampson. He stated later that Sampson had a gun.
I was down the street, yeah. I heard the gunshots, so I was down the street.
Even though Lewis was down the street, he was charged with murdering his friend. He spoke to us from prison.
Yeah, it was shocking. It was crushing, like, you know what I'm saying? Especially the fact of playing in that he was a close friend of mine. He was my brother.
Soyote says he sees felony murder used often in cases when it's one of the felons who's committed a killing.
My thoughts on felony murder is the idea behind it, I'm actually not opposed to.
But in a case like Lewis's, Soyote feels the punishment doesn't fit the crime. He routinely sees first-time offenders charged with robbery like Lewis take plea deals and serve only a few years in prison. Lewis refused a deal that would have required him to plead guilty to his best friend's murder. A jury found him guilty of both robbery and murder. He received a 20-year sentence that he must serve in its entirety.
The fact that Mr. Lewis is doing 20 years is mind-boggling. And for that reason, I know there's an issue with felony murder, because that just shouldn't be.
The officer, meanwhile, was cleared of wrongdoing. In recent years, Chicago has had some of the highest numbers of shootings by police officers of any large city. Femi Soyode says a felony murder charge like Tevin Lewis's adds to his community's distrust of the police.
It just further reiterates what people already feel about law enforcement. And not only does it reinforce it, it takes it to a new level.
It's difficult to know how often prosecutors use felony murder in the U.S., but one report states that nearly 20% of murder convictions are based on felony murder.
I think the felony murder rule causes people to plead guilty to crimes that they didn't commit to avoid extremely harsh sentences. I think it's a big part of mass incarceration.
In response to the 2016 investigation by the Chicago Reader, the office of Anita Alvarez, Cook County State's attorney at the time, told the paper, "The murder charges are well-founded under established law." The current state's attorney, Kimberly Fox, came to office in late 2016. Her office said in a statement that when deciding to charge felony murder, it conducts an additional review process that considers the offender's role and conduct during the commission of the underlying felony, whether he was armed or discharged a weapon, and if he has a previous criminal history. Fox has not used felony murder to prosecute in cases of shootings by the police. But the rule is still on the books in Illinois, as it is in Alabama, where Lakeith Smith is now serving his 65-year sentence.
I don't agree with that particular law. It just doesn't make sense.
Brontina Smith says her son plans to appeal his murder conviction.
A couple of questions, Gus.
Yes, sir.
Don't mind me asking you guys. What's going on with the, you know, that police woman who decided to break into, well, she found herself in that black man's apartment, and she decided to shoot him. What happened? What's going on with that?
For the Dallas Morning News, I'm Christopher Nguyen. This is part two of a special report, The Death of Botham Jean, Amber Geiger on Trial. If you haven't listened to the previous episode, go back and start from the beginning to get the whole story. And please note, this episode contains mature subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
No cameras were allowed inside as prospective jurors received instructions from Judge Tammy Kemp before filling out a questionnaire and leaving by lunch.
On Friday, September 13th, the jury was selected in the trial of Dallas police officer Amber Geiger, who was charged with murder for killing 26-year-old Botham Jean in his apartment.
Amber Geiger walked into the Frank Crowley Courts building alongside her attorney. On the judge's order, no one is allowed to speak publicly about the high-profile case. But through court records, we now know potentially crucial evidence in Geiger's upcoming trial, including the then-Dallas police officer working almost 14 hours the very day she shot and killed Botham Jean in his apartment.
Jennifer Emily is covering the Amber Geiger trial for the Dallas Morning News. Hi, Jen.
Hello.
So the last time we spoke, you told me more about who Jean was, and we heard from his mother, Allison Jean. Now the jury has been chosen, and testimony is scheduled to begin on September 23rd. So, Jen, before jury selection even started, you asked two veteran criminal lawyers what the prosecution and defense might be looking for.
Yes, I spoke with two Dallas attorneys, Brad Lawler and Russell Wilson. Neither lawyer is involved in the trial of Amber Geiger, but I've watched them in court for more than a decade. They've both tried all kinds of cases and had plenty to say about this one.
I would want somebody who can swear to me they're going to require the defense to do what they're supposed to do.
That's Brad Lawler. He is part of the capital murder unit at the public defender's office.
I would want somebody who promises, well, who first of all understands fully the proposed defense of mistake of fact. And that is, you never get there unless you find that the defendant acts reasonably in the mistake, in making the mistake in the first place. So I'd make sure about that. The other thing I think is important is you do want to try to find people who have not been maybe personally affected by the actions of the defendant.
Yeah, as the prosecutor in the case, I'm wanting to know if people are closely aligned with law enforcement in such a way that when they learn Amber Geiger is a police officer, that they would give her a greater benefit of the doubt than they would the ordinary person on the street.
And that's Russell Wilson. He once headed the Conviction Integrity Unit at the Dallas County District Attorney's Office, so he has a clear idea of what a prosecutor will be looking for in a case like this. He's now a defense attorney, and he also knows what kind of jurors Geiger's attorneys are looking for.
Because there's no particular entitlement that police officers are entitled to under the law, although many members of the community will say, hey, no, if it's a cop or a police officer, I believe them. I also would want to know how they felt about, you know, their home environment. And I'll probably have questions that tended to, I certainly would want to know if they'd ever had experiences dealing with a potential home intruder or anything like that. And I'm trying to go away from jurors who I believe would identify with Ms. Geiger. And I'm trying to go toward jurors who I believe would identify with Mr. Botham, which would be, you know, the homeowner sleep in the bed. And so if you had, for example, previously had an incident where you had confronted an intruder, you know, or came and had called the police for a burglary call on your house, then I might be concerned that that may make you tend to identify more with the defendant. I think a lot of times jurors tend to lean toward the person whose personal experiences are closest to their own.
How hard is this case going to be for jurors to, you know, put aside the pressure from the community and their own beliefs and, you know, not talk to their spouses, their kids, or anybody else about it, to just really focus on the evidence and reach a conclusion? It seems like it is more than, even more than most cases, there's a lot of pressure here. How hard is it going to be?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult for a jury. I would not at all be surprised if a jury is unable to reach a verdict.
Yeah, I think it will be a challenge. Anytime there's a loss of life, every murder case, one of the questions I certainly ask is just the fact that there's a loss of life makes a lot of emotions come out. You can't help but feel for the Botham family. And so folks are going to have to struggle with, I think, a lot of issues beyond those that are actually in the jury charge. So we'll have kind of a statement of the law, and then you'll have kind of what I would call a sentiment of the case. So I think jurors are going to have to have a challenge with that. Now, I do think it will be a difficult case to deal with. But I think you can find folks in the community that are able to do it. I mean, we've gotten verdicts out of so many other cases, and I do think it's important that the community be able to trust the process, that and that the process is transparent. I'm hoping that the court gives lots of access to the media, because people are watching the case and people want to see what happens. And regardless of what happens in the case, I think it's important that we, as a community, have confidence in the process.
I think the biggest issue for the defense is this, and we've kind of already talked about it. Clearly, Amber Geiger was at fault. She's the one that pulled the trigger causing the death of Botham Jean. But under our law, if she did that through the mistaken belief she was in her own apartment at the time, the law excuses criminal prosecution, period. That's the biggest hurdle, I think, that the defense will be looking at in this case. The natural inclination of a juror would be to say, I want her to be responsible in some way. Well, and again, that, you know, responsibility, fault, is determined in the civil courthouse, not in the criminal courthouse. The criminal courthouse determines whether or not there has been a crime committed. And under our law, it is an absolute defense if the culpability required for the offense is negated by mistake of fact.
You know, I think that's such a I do agree mistake of fact to certainly be a central issue, but again, it's very difficult to reconcile, even if you look, for example, with the case of Carolyn Davis and the person, or the many times where we see the intoxicated driver or the kid that's racing, or folks that engage in a variety of different conducts that do cause death that end up seeing criminal prosecutions. And so, you know, I think as a juror, when they say that you bring your experience, you weigh those situations in your mind. They certainly aren't the evidence in that particular case. But, you know, as a practical matter, I think folks often draw on their personal experiences.
Jen, it's clear that nothing in this case is going to be simple. But what we know is that this jury will now decide whether Geiger shooting Jean is a crime.
Yes, and if it is a crime, is it murder? Or is it something else? Or is Geiger not guilty?
And we'll unpack all of that in our next episode. Jen, thank you.
Thank you.
Then once you convict them, automatic execution. And I'm asking the white people to ask their legislators to say that's what we want. See, with a machine gun and say you're cleaning up the drug problem, see, you are running a game on us.
A prominent donor to the Democratic Party, a man by the name of Ed Buck, has been arrested after a third man nearly died of an overdose in his West Hollywood home. Now, previously, two men died of an overdose in his home. And that raised a number of questions, and now we have some answers. So I wanted to share them with you. Buck was charged for administering methamphetamine, maintaining a drug house, and for alleged battery causing serious injury. If convicted, he could face more than 5 years in prison, which sounds like an awfully short period of time, in my opinion. Prosecutors sought to have Buck's bail set at a whopping $4 million. To support that, they said that Buck is, quote, a predator with no regard for human life, who gave the victims dangerously large doses of narcotics. Now, in two prior incidents, 55-year-old Timothy Dean and 26-year-old Jamel Moore were both found dead of methamphetamine overdoses at his home, at Buck's home. Both of them were black and gay men. So far, authorities have said that the third man who overdosed is 37 years old.
Okay, so this guy's a prominent Democratic donor in Los Angeles. And there's been allegations that he has used his sway with politicians to avoid scrutiny in the past. And Jesus, two different guys died from meth overdoses in his house. That's not a coincidence. I don't think that that's a coincidence. And now the third guy overdoses, luckily didn't die.
Mm-hmm.
About time we did something about this. And so the stories about this guy who targets particularly vulnerable black gay men, mm-hmm. Okay.
Sometimes homeless men.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so some of the quotes are devastating. We can get to them in a sec. So that in and of itself is a disastrous story, a fascinating story of how he uses power and privilege to target these people without power, I guess for sexual kicks, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe he feels like he could wield power over them if he gets them more addicted and on even more dangerous drugs. And we'll let the case play out, you know, in the courts. And I'm glad that finally the LA prosecutors are doing something about it. But there's a second component to it, too, which is the problem with our system of financing politicians. Since he gave, in this case, it's not the Republicans, it's Democrats. Okay, since he gave a lot of money to Democrats, he, you know, he was considered an important person and given benefit of the doubt over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so, if we didn't have private financing of elections, he's another guy, like you, like me, like anybody else, right? But since he's rich and he, you know, has courted favor with politicians, he got to get away with this stuff for a lot longer than any other person would have.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, look, we know that there's a two-tier justice system based on socioeconomic status. So if you're wealthy, you're treated very differently from judges. You're viewed differently by a jury. You have the resources to hire the absolute best defense attorney. But in this case, you have the combination of someone who's rich and gets to take advantage of a two-tier justice system, in addition to his political connections, which also, you know, help him out in situations like this. Now, luckily, you know, there, it looks like there are going to be consequences to his actions, but two people are gone. They died in his home, and it's insane that it took a third person who overdosed to get prosecutors to act and do something about this. And by the way, I want to read you something, a piece of evidence that is really important to this case. So in a December 2016 entry, a journal entry, Moore, one of the victims, Jamel Moore, wrote that he had, quote, become addicted to drugs, and the worst one at that, Ed Buck is the one to thank.
That quote is devastating. So we can give you more and more quotes from their family members, but the one that the guy wrote before he died of an overdose is very damning. Look, we have a system of justice in this country. He'll have his day in court, but the guy writing before he died, he got me hooked on these drugs and he's the one to thank. Now a third person overdosing. Look, we got to put an end to predators. That's point one, but point two is we got to put an end to private financing so these guys can't just turn to the politicians and go, come on, get me out of another death and another death, etc. And I just looked it up. I had no idea which politicians, which Democratic, I knew he's a Democratic donor, which Democratic politicians he gave to. It's a who's who of corporate Democrats.
Right.
And to LA Democratic Party,
because
that's where he needs the power most.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 21st, 2019, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, counter-racist suggestions you'd like to offer. The number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Whew, lots to share for this week. Let's see. So we get started. We are listener supported. Counter Racist Radio Invest. If you think the program is constructive, you can hit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, you can also use Cash App. The Cash App address, it should be linked in the description. It is cash.app/$ the cows. Very simple. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested. I hope the program, The Cows, has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. If you are not into all of the technology, drop me an email. We can get you a physical mailing address to support. Huge thanks to all the folks who have made it possible for us to broadcast for a decade. You can also hit our wish list. It is at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. Much obliged to our investors who have nabbed items over the past 10 years. I hope The Cows has provided accurate information about what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what it means to be classified as white, and what non-white people can do to solve this problem as soon as possible. Alrighty, next up, The Cows 10-year anniversary, 2019 counter-racist yoga retreat in Florida. Our deadline for deposits Sunday, this past Sunday, September 15th. Now, very similar to what happened when we did the retreat in Virginia in February, which seems like, you know, 50 years ago. But very similarly, I was not certain if we had enough people, and then kind of closer to the deadline, there were a lot more responses. There had already been responses and people had already signed up, but just there were more as we got closer to the deadline. Something very similar happened this time. Even some of it even spilled over the deadline, so it made it challenging to get a final count in terms of how many folks we had. I do not blame any of the folks for this. I say this is my fault. I'm still learning at planning retreats, even having done one. We've only done one. So still learning with this and many other things. My goal for this retreat and for any and all future retreats is to have roughly 3 months from the time, not just from, you know, talking and saying, oh, we're going to do a retreat in Florida, but like, bam, we have all the information. This is the price. This is the exact location. This is the exact residence that we're looking at. And, you know, all of the details, having that like 7 months before whenever the date is for the event. And then we can all sign up 4 months prior to, meaning the deposit and all that, so people will have more time. It was a much shorter timeline this time, even though it was better. We had super short timelines for the other attempted retreats and the successful retreat in Virginia. They were very, very short timelines. I think I've said consistently that most of the retreats that I see planned, a lot of them are planned a year in advance. Most of them at least a good 8-9 months so that people can plan accordingly. Still learning, planning, having 500 year plans, a year plan, still learning the best way to plan so that it won't be, people won't feel like they have to rush at the last minute and all of that. So giving you that information, it's my fault, still learning. Once we get it together and have a great plan for organizing retreats to make it efficient and fun, after we've done it a few times, we'll have that whole code together. At this point, still learning. As such, I extended the deadline to Monday just so that I can have an accurate count for everyone who has signed up and is there. That way I'll know for sure the exact number of folks that we are working with. The information is all listed on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com, Davenport, Florida, flying into the Orlando airport. Davenport is not that far from Orlando. We'd be staying December 28th to January 1st, ending 2019, and hopefully starting 2020 in a constructive manner, at least with yoga and a healthy vegan meal, if nothing else. but having a constructive start to the new year. We'll be doing yoga every day, the same as we did in Virginia, doing some yoga every day. All of the meals will be plant-based, and we'll be doing counter-racist workshops in addition to workshops on healthy eating. I think that's so important. We had some of the, or at least one person who participated in our Virginia retreat, lost more than 30 pounds just changing his diet, doing a little more exercise, 30 pounds. So counter-racist workshops, vegan meal workshops as well. Chef Nadira, she was with us in VA and had extraordinary, and that is minimizing the brilliance of her cuisine. But she will be making the trek from VA down to Florida, I think happily, to get out of VA, down to Florida to hang out and provide vegan meals for all of our stay. Should be spectacular. People did email about if they had like recipes or requests for vegan meals. Once we get a final tally and all of that, we did that in Virginia. I think I sent out a survey and Chef Nadira gave me some input as well about the menus, but absolutely. So giving folks until Monday to finalize, make a decision so that I'll have final tally on who's going to Florida for the counter-racist yoga retreat. And trying to do things early. The earlier you do things, the better the prices tend to be, especially for flights and that sort of thing. So planning earlier. Anywho, Monday, deadline, drop an email if you have questions, need additional information, anything of the sort, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Please don't use social media or anything else to contact about the retreat. Untiljustice@gmail.com. I am not sure if some of the stragglers for the event, some of the folks who were kind of late in responding that they might be interested in participating. I am not sure if the vegan peach cobbler had anything to do with it, because I did mention that on the program last week and saying that, you know, if it comes out well, this would be something that I'd be willing to cook at the retreat. Even though peaches are not in season in December, I did say it probably have to be a substitution for a different type of fruit. But wow, even with some obstacles, the peach cobbler, vegan peach cobbler, was made. Wow, I was so impressed. It turned out so great. People asked for the recipe. I guess I could write it up and share. I was not anticipating requests for the recipe, but wow, I was really surprised at how great it turned out. Carnivores and vegans approved. Even small children approved. It was spectacular, and in addition to it being vegan peach cobbler, and I am someone, not only have I never made a regular cobbler of any sort, I'm not even like a cobbler fan in my tubby days. That was not even, you know, something I dined on. Anyway, in addition to this being a vegan cobbler, this was a sugarless vegan cobbler, which was not even, you know, my plan going into it. But I do know that, you know, in this system of white supremacy where they poison us all the time, that white sugar is in everything. When they talk about diabetes and black people are lazy and you don't go, well, they kind of poison a lot of the food. Same thing I've been saying regularly. They don't put grocery stores where you can have lots of fresh produce that doesn't have sugar in everything, and organic offerings doesn't have white sugar and everything. They just load your neighborhood up with liquor stores and Popeye's chicken shacks. Well, might have some problems with your diet, with health. At any rate, getting sugar out of as many meals as possible, that'll probably be something that we would touch on at the Florida Yoga Retreat, some of the food workshops, and just in general with the meals that are being prepared, trying to eliminate sugar and or find substitutes completely. As I began the process of cooking, and I knew this recipe does call for sugar, the vegan recipe, I just said, hey, there are fruit alternatives, mung fruit, powdered monk fruit. That was what I used instead. It's 1-to-1. So if it calls for 1 cup of sugar, 1 cup of powdered monk fruit. It is sweet. I tried it previously. I am not a big sugar person. Not that I don't eat sweets. They have vegan donuts that I enjoy and all kinds of pastries. I made vegan brownies like a couple weeks ago. Right on. They're tasty. All of that said, it would still be great to not have all that white sugar, period. Switched it, used monk fruit. I didn't even tell any of the folks who tried it. I just said that it was vegan. I didn't even, I forgot to mention totally that, oh yeah, it's sugarless too. And it didn't even matter. It was devoured in 48 hours. That is the metaphor. The proof is in the pudding cliche. The proof is in the empty pot. 48 hours. There was no another metaphor. There was no arm twisting. There was no begging and bribing people. I didn't have to eat the whole cobbler myself. I went to get a final bowl and it was all gone. 48 hours, vegan, sugarless peach cobbler. I don't know if we could do, as I said, peach cobbler in Florida because it's not peach season. And I think you really have to have spectacular peaches for this dish. To be great. So I'm not sure if I'd be as enthused about trying it with frozen peaches or canned peaches. I don't really do canned fruit. We probably have to swap. It'd probably be equally delicious with apples. I like apple cobbler. We could probably switch and do apple cobbler, or by winter, sweet potato pie. We could just switch. I said next, that is the next baking vegan thing I would like to conquer. Vegan sweet potato pie. Could probably make that sugarless too. That would be in season for December. Vegan sweet potato pie. I think we could put that on the menu. I love sweet potato pie. Start 2020 with really good vegan sweet potato pie. Next. Can I give high commendation to Mumia Abu-Jamal? Wow. He has been in greater confinement for longer than some people listening to this program have been alive, easily. Was on death row for a sizable chunk of those years as well, and has had extraordinary health problems while he has been there, suffering from hepatitis and no self-care at all in Philadelphia's greater confinement, Pennsylvania, rather. Victim of white supremacy to the max. All of that said, he continues to be an extraordinary journalist. And I mean, that current NPR just did that report this week about, hey, why not criminal charges for the pharmaceutical companies? And Mumia Abu-Jamal, I think his report was even before the NPR report was published. And he consistently is so informed from a global standpoint as well, not just about things that are happening in Pennsylvania, but so informed. And he does such a good job of reminding people about the terrorist assault on the MOVE organization. We had Ramona Africa. Woo! We had Ramona Africa on the program. Cal's listeners probably know I'm snickering thinking of the legend, Sue Africa, also a guest in the Cal's archives. Anyway, but he always references their work and the terrorist attack against the MOVE organization in Philadelphia and contrasting that to other events. Just an extraordinary illustration of a journalist, period. And then under those circumstances where whites have worked so diligently to muzzle him, use that word deliberately, man not. Next, the Amber Geiger trial. I would encourage folks to be mindful. I don't know if that still got the national attention, but be mindful. There are updates and the trial is about to begin. I attempted to find information about the racial classification of the jury, and I failed to get that information. I thought they were going to share it in the audio segment that I played, and they did not. I was so disappointed. So if anybody has time and would like to do research, the racial composition of the Amber Geiger jury in Dallas, that's where she shot the unarmed black male. If anybody can find that information, if it's been released, that would be wonderful and appreciated. Let's see. I guess last thing I'll say for right now, the segment that I played early on about mothering so white, it was a black female author, and she talked about adopting black children. Nefertiti Austin is her name, victim of racism. Number one, spectacular. Adopting black children, that's something that we've talked about on this program before. Dr. Umar Johnson, he was a guest on the board. He's been a guest many times, but in 2013 specifically, we began a segment talking about that being an act of counter-racism for black people to adopt. Dr. Welsing would call them throwaway children to keep them out of the clutches of the Jerry Sanduskys, Jerry Epsteins. But adopting black children, or at least being a foster parent. I think I talked to a different Cows listener, and one of her friends, foster parent, and is taking care of a black child right now. I gave high commendation. That is spectacular counter-racist effort. So I appreciate Miss Austin for bringing that out in her book and adopting a black child. Bravo. However, within all of that, it sounded like, and she has VGQ, but it sounded like there was still a lot of judgment about black people. Like she was saying, unless I misunderstood, that she broke the code. And I, you know, kind of perked up at that, like, oh, let's see what the code is. And she said she broke the code that black people generally adopt children that they know from other relatives who might be having a tough time, so that they kind of know the family member, the parents, or whatever it is. They don't just go and adopt a stranger through the adoption system. And that was breaking the code. And I thought, again, context of white supremacy. And I was immediately reminded, got to see if we can get her back on the program again. She's been with us many times over the years. She's one of my favorite guests, Dorothy Roberts. Her book, Shattered Bonds, it is all about the foster care system. And she is very accurate in assessing the context of white supremacy, which dominates the foster care, adoption, child welfare system, and it's specifically focused on the United States. But she talks about it, and she writes explicitly saying that it is tailored to make it easy for white children, for white abducting parents to get whatever child they want, black, white, or other. It is not set up for a black single mom, a black single dad, a black family even. It is not set up and tailored for them to be advantaged to go and adopt a child. Certainly not a white child, but a child, period. That's not what it's set up for. The same way that the foster care system is not set up to make sure that black families are together and all of that. It is set up to easily be able to go in and snatch black children. Minister Malcolm X talked about that, and Dorothy Roberts talked about that in Shattered Bonds. She was a guest on the program in 2010. We talked about that book exclusively. I can switch the terms up. But that was one. It sounded like there was a judgment about black people not adopting black children. Then it went from that, and we had to go talk about cliche toxic black males and not showing their emotions and how damaging this can be. How does a conversation that starts out talking about adoption and we somehow end up getting back to the trope of toxic black masculinity? Dr. Tommy Curry, the man not race, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood. In the segments that we heard, Amber Geiger shooting down a black male. Black males go out. One of them gets shot and killed, and his friends get charged with the murder, even though none of them pulled the trigger. An enforcement officer did. In that context, toxic black masculinity. And with Dr. Curry even saying that the whole origin of that term is about white men, not victims of toxic white masculinity. Anywho, let's see. Yes, I will stop there. Metaphors. There were a number of metaphors, as there always are, in the audio segments that we heard this week. I consistently request that participants are mindful about what we say. That's the whole or one primary goal. A regular bit of emphasis in counter-racism is to be for us to be precise with our choice of terms and definitions for those terms. Racists, they will regularly employ metaphors, similes, comparisons to insist that two separate entities are identical, exactly alike, and frequently that is not the case at all. Race soldiers are super skilled at using these metaphors to employ deception and to find different phrases that simply reinforce ideas and concepts of white supremacy. Victims of white supremacy, including Gus T, we have been exposed to this misconduct for centuries, and we are still learning. I've said that quite a few times today. As such, frequently, we do not have logic to articulate our views, and as such, we will substitute an analogy or metaphor of some sort. Frequently, this just adds to the confusion. If we could make an effort to be explicit, direct, exact about what it is that we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. If we could take 5 minutes to share our thoughts, questions, suggestions, that would be appreciated. Just make sure everyone gets at least one chance to speak. And then once everyone is shared at least once, if you have additional thoughts or suggestions, we should have ample time for you to share. If we have any of our listeners in Canada, if you have any thoughts on what is happening with the Prime Minister, that would be grand to hear as well. I'm sure folks in the States have paid attention to that global system of white supremacy in my mind immediately. The Coon Man, Robert Northam, I feel he should be Time's Man of the Year or Person of the Year. That's what it is now. Patriarchy, Time's Person of the Year. It should be Ralph Northam. Went through that whole Coon Man scandal, and University of Virginia wins the national championship in basketball. He keeps his job, and the black lieutenant governor who thought he was going to be replacing Northam, now he's the one in trouble and facing rape allegations. Man of the year, VA's governor, the Coon Man. He should call, never mind. The number again is 605-313-5164, be code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you have questions, details about the retreat, untiljustice@gmail.com. Let's see. First few folks dialed in with a hand up. If you have questions, suggestions, comments to share, lines should be open. Proceed. No way.
Hello.
Greetings.
Hi, everyone. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. They were great. I was going to say great clips, but they were great clips. I was thinking of something else. But I think I said a couple of weeks ago there was going to be a speaker, and I did take some notes. I did want to talk about that. I talked about, you know, going to speaking engagements, the lectures in the community. So his name was Dr. Gergel. Of course, he was assigned the judge, the federal judge in Dylan Roof case. But he was there to talk about his book, Unexampled Courage, excuse me. And he talks of Isaac Woodard, who was a black man returning to his home after serving the country in World War II, excuse me. He wanted to go to the bathroom. He's supposed to let him off. The white bus driver got upset. Gets to the next stop. The police come, beat him up, blind him, you know. And what happened, transpired after that. Again, it's called Unexampled Courage, and the level of courage of Sergeant Woodard on par, equal to the judge in the case, some judge named Judge Waring, which happened to be the courtroom he was in, that he served in. So Judge Waring was a judge around this time who read about this case. Him and his wife, they were, you know, oh, no, poor black guy. It went to, I guess, their social justice activities after that, and how brave Harry Truman was because he saw this case like, oh, no, we have to integrate the military because of this. And I guess these were what we call our good white people and things like that. He talked a lot about a lot of things. They had what would be, I guess, equivalent to a GoFundMe for Mr. Woodard with there was a concert in New York because he had to flee and move to New York, and Joe Louis was there, and, you know, they had a big concert to help with medical expenses and things like that. He had to fight for his pension, but because he got hurt, I guess, not during military activity because he was on a bus. They tried to give him a hard way, something to go about the pension. Eventually he got it, went on to live his life the best he could, seemed very productive, lived in New York, was able to buy some properties, blah, 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 stuff like that. He went into the history, researching for the book. He said he talked to Julian Bond, I thought of you, because you said that was your professor when you were in Virginia. And he gave two books. One was called Mind of the South by W.J. Cash, and the other one was actually a report. It's about 2,000 pages. He said 1,400, but I looked. I guess there are two volumes. It's about 2,000 pages. Could never be read on the program. It's called The American Dilemma. Again, some of you may have heard of these books. And the man's name is Geir Mendel. I'll email it to you, the spelling, because it's a Swedish person. But the name of the volume is called The American Dilemma. Most people can spell that. Again, I didn't get a chance to ask questions. It was pretty short, but he said a lot of information. He said this book has been optioned to a PBS special, so, you know, he's going to continue to receive, you know, accolades. His wife helped him during the research. The Judge Waring person, the white judge, a lot of his documents are at Howard. Things like that. I think that's all. Oh, and then the lecture is called the Lamar Lecture, and I just looked into that. I guess there's a Southern Studies program, and this lady, Miss Lamar, that's her married name, sponsored this program, and which is really, you know, significant. I guess, you know, she had the resources to do that. A white lady who was actually opposed to women voting. To women's suffrage, which I thought was interesting, that this would be the person that they would name this program after that would affect all Southerners, all races, all genders, all those types of things. So hopefully, I'll try to hopefully organize this more. This might be a good person for the show, Dr. Richard Burgle. He didn't talk anything about the Dylan Roof. He talked case, all he talked about was the primarily the first book, because that's what they asked him to speak about, the book. Any questions? I felt like I went all over the place. Have any questions?
Let's see. Well, Julian Bond, the late Julian Bond, professor at University of Virginia. The University of Virginia, again. Gunnar Myrdal has been mentioned many times on the program. In fact, Pamela Evans Harris mentions him in some of her writings. And just because it was mentioned on Workplace Racism yesterday, Danielle McGuire, in her book At the Dark End of the Street, which is about white men raping black females, she starts that book with a quote from Gunnar Myrdal about sex being a core element of why racism is set up. But yes, that book specifically gets referenced regularly when people talk about racism, white supremacy. Let's see, Dr. Gergel, I am not surprised that this white man, a judge no less, who adjudicated the Dylann Roof trial, would come in under these circumstances. That's what they say, right? But under these circumstances, with our current president and everything that's going on and the shootings and everything else, that he would come in and not talk about the Dylann Roof trial, just talk about his book. That is pretty typical in a system of racism, white supremacy. I'm glad you were able to attend the event. Would have been grand if you could have got some questions about, you know, the Dylann Roof trial in, or, you know, whatever else. WJ Cash, I'm going to check on that text as well. Yeah, I guess, yeah, if you think he might be worth checking out for a guest, you can, if you got contact information, or I guess just his name and general resources, that would be good. I'll research that and see if we can get him to come on the program, if it would be worthwhile.
Because he said this story needs to be told. He did emphasize that this story needs to be told to everyone. And quite a few of the black people who were there, BGQ, were very excited that he was able to be there to write this book and tell this story. And one did ask about, because they apologized to the family, and someone asked, was an apology enough? So I was like, yay. But then he was like, well, there's nothing to do. I'm like, cash, that's what I'm thinking in my head. But one black person did ask, is an apology enough?
Right on. VGQ, for folks, if we have newer listeners, VGQ victims, guaranteed qualified, just meaning that any victim of white supremacy, any non-white person, can take any position on the system of white supremacy that they like, and that is valid. VGQ. Much obliged.
Well, that's all I have about that. No problem.
Thank you kindly for sharing. If you can give me the name, that would be grand. And I encourage other victims to check, you know, go to your library, or if there's a college, community college, especially if you got a larger college, university, go and check, because they'll have speakers on a regular basis. Sometimes they'll just have some sort of email or alert that you can get that will just give you notifications about speakers and events that are coming up. And you'll probably see something, especially with things as they are. They will have events related to racism, white supremacy. The academic school year just began. They'll have things happening. You can check and see, you know, authors, speakers that are coming in, and you can get practice asking questions, questioning white people. Other folks that we've missed totally, if you have comments, suggestions, questions, proceed. Let's see. While folks are spectating or getting to a spot where they can speak, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. For the listeners who are in Canada, I believe Calvin Lawrence should be hanging out with us in the next few days. I'll give, you know, exact date and time and all that stuff later. But he is a victim of white supremacy, and he is, he's retired now, an enforcement officer in Toronto for a number of years. And he writes about workplace racism, not being called a nigger, but white people saying nigger in his presence. And he felt like they were doing this deliberately to try to make him, you know, chimp out. Phrase I've used here for years. But he should be coming on the program. He wrote a book about his workplace experience and the code that he developed to deal with this. Always am interested in hearing black people talk about codes they develop for dealing with racism on the job. So that should be grand. And he just had a book published, as I said, detailing all of this. His publishers, they got me the book, so I'm going to start reading that promptly. Reading is more important than watching television. I'll let folks know if it is worth the read. But listeners in the Canada area, Mr. Lawrence, he should be visiting us. I think he said he resides in Halifax. He was giving some of the background history on that part of the world and the history of black people and racism, basically, and north of the border. But he should be coming to visit the cows shortly. Let's see. Folks who dialed in, if we've not heard from you at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Hello. Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, salutations, Gus and everybody on the call. So school is back in full swing for sure for everyone, and I've been substituting as I normally do, and I substituted a PE class.
Your volume is a little low. If you could maybe get a little closer to the receiver.
Can you hear me better?
Ah, much better, much better.
Okay. Yeah, so I was doing a PE class, which I was actually kind of proud to be able to do because since Dr. Ruby was on, I've gone vegan, and I really have been exercising. So I've been able to keep, I was able to keep up with the kids during the class, but it was pretty interesting because there was an older white woman that also co-taught part of the class, and she was kind of acting starstruck. I know that's a metaphor, but she literally was like trying to ask a lot of questions, and how she was like, her eyes were wide, like she was really trying to observe my physique or something. And then the younger white female called herself, I guess, trying to help me out, telling me how things were going to go. But a lot of stuff she told me ended up being misinformation. And it caused some problems as far as like where the class was supposed to gather for attendance. It wasn't major, but I was like, okay, I see you know, had to throw a little bit of confusion in there, which, you know, trying to pretend like you were being helpful. So in the gym class, I met a young white female. She's about seventh or sixth grade. She had very short hair. And she walked up to me and she said, I just want you to know my name is. And she told me the name. It was a male name. So later on when they were outside doing laps, I ended up kind of catching up with her or whatever. She caught up with me. And so I said, do you mind if I ask you a question about your transition? She said, oh, it's no problem. So I said, well, that is right. You're transitioning. She was like, yeah, well, sort of. I'm not cis male and I'm not cis female, whatever that is. I'm still confused about how to use that word. She was like, I'm just a human being. And my question to her, if she would have been an adult, would have been, well, can you be a human being without representing yourself as a white male? And I did find that interesting. She's a white female, and she somehow has understood that to be ultimately human to her is to be a white male. So let's see, the next thing, I actually, because of the book we just finished, I looked up Mr. DeBecker's site, and it was really interesting, and I encourage other listeners that were interested in the book to take a look. It might lead to further questions and inquiries about the system of racism, white supremacy, and its insistence to expand or maintain, because he has several instances of protection that he offers on the website, like one being college campuses. Another one was... I can't remember, Ma. I was trying to look on the site while I was on the phone right now, but it's several offerings, and there was a picture I found very interesting at first when I went on the site. It was of a young white woman with a white male leading her in front, and then the white female, and her back is turned, or her head is turned to the back, and there's a black male bodyguard or something behind her, which kind of gave a double, I guess, entendre that he's protecting her, but she's also leery of his presence. But I did find the book useful despite the racist incorrectness, and I appreciate Dr. Mania recommending it. Thank you, Gus, for, hosting the reading. And let's see, I did appreciate the part where he said it's best not to invent things that produce destructive fear, because us being non-white victims of racism, I'm sure a lot of people suffer from anxiety, paranoia, worry, the worry that he mentioned, you know, especially just considering all situations in the system. Interestingly, a friend of mine used to live in Texas, and we were talking about Amber Geiger's situation, and she told me that, and I looked it up, basically Amber Geiger's representation requested a change of venue to a county over where she used to live, and she let me know it's all white. This is hearsay, but she lived there, so I'm going to take her word for it. It's all white, but they denied it. But she also requested a jury trial and sentencing. And in Texas, if she's convicted and she has no prior criminal charges, they can sentence her up to between 5 years to life. And if it's 10 years or less, they can recommend probation. So in my opinion, limited opinion, it's a kind of a masterstroke to, no matter what, keep her out of greater confinement or lesser confinement, whichever one it is, basically prison. And it's binding. The judge has to go with the jury sentencing. Let's see, I only have one other point. And you can check out, I found this information out on a blog when I Googled it. It was blog.bennettandbennett.com, and then there's other legal sites, but that's the site that gave the definition, basically, of what jury sentencing in Texas is. So definitely a masterstroke. She's probably not going to go to jail. And then I met a woman teaching at another school, and she was very friendly, overly friendly, and she shared with me voluntarily that her daughter had adopted two black males, one with alcohol syndrome, alcohol fetal syndrome, I think it is, and the other was heroin addicted. And she said the one that's on, that had the alcohol in his system, he's the really troubled one. He's really difficult. And I said, okay, you know, and I couldn't really get into it because I was kind of, you know, loosely doing my duties at the time. And so I said, well, and I probably shouldn't have, but I did because it was a young black male and I have a soft spot for kids. I said, well, my best advice is for her to research and look into cod liver oil for his brain development and function, and perhaps that'll help. But, you know, other than that, I really felt at a loss because I'm thinking about all the children that were adopted and abused or killed. And, you know, I think there was a clip you played not too long ago about a couple that sent a child to someone in America from Canada because they just didn't want them no more, and they lied on the child. Or I heard it somewhere. I'm just praying for those children. I'm praying for all the non-white children, and I hope everybody's having a good evening, and I'll mute my line for now, and thanks.
Much obliged, Irie. Thank you for sharing. Reading is more important than watching television. We did just finish up Gavin DeBecker's The Gift of Fear. Should be in the archives, even at iTunes. iTunes is current, and I think all of the sessions from The Gift of Fear should be there. He did have some constructive information, at least I think about workplace racism and dealing with violence and things. I think there were some constructive suggestions, and also I thought he practiced racism, white supremacy in a number of instances. O.J. Simpson, Al Sharpton, but be that as it may. Other folks that we have not. Thomas in New York. Greetings, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. In the clip, she called it the black program at school. I thought that was very interesting. We're going to the black program.
That was a he. So. I'm just interrupting because that was Seattle, and they emphasized that this individual identified as transgender and used the pronouns he, him. That's the only reason that I interrupted is that they stated that explicitly.
Oh, yeah. Well, what can you say about that? That lost my train of thought right there. Oh, Sackler.
See that? See confusion? Confusion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have a clip with Billy Fuller where he said, you know, this LGBT thing is going to be the most, he alludes to something like that. But the Sackler family, Arm & Hammer family, I think, should have had to pay for the crack epidemic. I know they had to realize their sales were going up and up and up, and no one wasn't making more cakes. But I don't see too much happening. They're going to pay a fine. And, if they get arrested or have to face some charges, quite sure all of the politicians they gave money to. Purdue Pharma, one of the largest lobbyists in the country. A lot of people will, also have to go to jail or have to face the penalty. So I expect them to be very well protected. We often say, I remember back in the DSL, I believe it is, or the DSM, something like that, where they list the mental illnesses. Homosexuality was once listed as a mental illness. And, in my opinion, it's a mental illness when a black male ends up in Ed Buck's apartment after what we already know about him. I mean, it just makes absolutely no sense. I mean, it's like, I don't want to use a simile, so I'm just going to leave it at that. He now have a report where he has up to 10 people who have said, black males, all of them, that while he was asleep, he injects them with methamphetamine, which, makes them up, and it also makes them sexually, very sexually aroused. And that's really what he wants, is this big black buck to bend them over. You know, that's his thing. So I just think he got that buck. Now the charges, hopefully he goes to jail. And we had Epstein, Harvey Weinstein, all Democratic donors, all attached to the Clintons. In fact, Epstein set up the Clinton Foundation. So talking about, I remember with the Pizzagate thing, a lot of people said that was fake news. It's looking like that. Anything could be true when it comes down to these people's sexual debauchery. Canada, Justin Trudeau, blackface, brownface. I never heard brownface. That's the first. He was dressed up like the Swamis, and he had the brownface. It still looks like blackface to me. But on three occasions with pictures, even singing. So Gus, Canada is now officially North Virginia. They got in the title of North Virginia. They even Drake was in blackface. I got pictures of Drake in blackface. Very interesting. Up there north of the border. Trump in orangeface. Sometimes truth hurts. He said Baltimore was a disaster. Vote trap, crime infested, dilapidated buildings, urban decay. Called out Elijah Cummings and other black politicians for misappropriating the federal funds that he gave them. And black people say he's a racist. Then he goes to San Francisco this week, and he said the white people with their hypodermic needles, heroin fiending everywhere, polluting the ocean, something needs to be done about this. And all this white homelessness and white people living in tent streets is disgusting. Bringing in the Environment Protection Agency to look into violating them and giving them some potential sanctions. Not to mention his talk about death row, which the UN did a report on a few years ago. That death row was mostly black, and people living in tents. They said it had conditions which looked like third world living conditions, which means non-white world. So they also went to Lawrence, Alabama, found hookworm, Flint, Michigan to monitor the water, Detroit to monitor the bankruptcy, and the UN said all three places, all those places, or four of those places, was in the third world countries. However, I liked how he approached San Francisco, all white, very, very wealthy city, in a sanctuary city, helping people who cross the border as opposed to their own citizens, white citizens. Very interesting. 690,000 people live in public housing in New York City. Majority of that in the projects. Four identical 34 buildings, 4,000 residents in Harlem, the Polo Grounds. You got Queensbridge, 6,500 people, 96 buildings, 5 floors each. And no one ever goes to the wrong apartment. It's like, how does this happen? You're a cop. End up at the wrong apartment in a housing complex. I mean, I've been to projects where the elevators go from the first floor, third floor, fifth, every other odd floor. You know, you got to get out, walk to the staircase, walk down or up one flight to get to your floor and stuff, and no one goes to the wrong apartments. And I just don't believe this story. I still think in order for them to get a conviction, which is still no guarantee in the system of white supremacy, they will have to show some type of connection if these two knew each other beforehand or something like that. Yes, that's it.
All right, on. Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I can confess I have gone to the wrong apartment. I didn't walk all the way in, but I did get to the door. I was pulling out my key and recognized, whoop, I'm at the wrong apartment, which, you know, hey, I did way better than Amber Geiger. I didn't get into the residence. I don't even think I tried the door to see if it was open. I was just pulling out my key and whoop, I am not at the right floor. Whoops. *61 if you have commentary to share. I don't think they're going to convict that white woman. I just, it's Texas. And when I've heard the commentary about them asking for a change of venue, Rodney King, Simi Valley. But I also now, because it's in Dallas, I think of sundown towns, James Lowen, and he talked about all the areas that surround Dallas that are all white, super racist codes, no niggers here, can't have the niggers in our schools and all of that. Like, oh, wow. Like they system of racism, white supremacy. Reading is more important than watching television. I guess one thing I would say really quick, I think often we minimize the power that whites have over victims of white supremacy who are in a very vulnerable position. Terry Crews is a big black male, and he says that he was sexually terrorized by white males, grabbed his genitals and all of that. I think victims of racism frequently are in very vulnerable positions where they can be easily manipulated by powerful racist predators. There are so many documentaries, certainly not that I'm encouraging anybody to watch TV. There's a documentary on Jeffrey Dahmer, and they talk to some of his black neighbors, and they have one black female victim, and she says that, you know, I used to hang out with him and we were friends, and we would eat dinner together. He would make food. She says, my goodness, he might have, you know, fed me somebody that he killed, and I just can't believe it. And system of racism, white supremacy, that's why I said, what does it mean to be white? I think most of us just do not grasp what it means, and whether it's Ed Buck, Mr. Epstein, Jerry Sandusky, Amber Geiger,
We just do not grasp what it means to be white. And you have a lot of victims of white supremacy who are in very vulnerable positions because of racists. And because of that, very easy to exploit. Other folks that we've missed totally. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Imhan DC, with us for the VA retreat. Proceed, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings. And greetings to everyone. I had a few things I wanted to speak about. The first is there's this individual on YouTube. His name, C-O-E-N, first name, second name, N-A-N-I-C-K, if I spelled it right. But this individual, ice albino male, a white male, he is on YouTube and other social media explaining to black women how they can accept the rape of white males. And then another way I can put that is he's trying to convince black women to have sex with white men and telling them all the ways that they can dress, speak, and even please them sexually. There's a whole lot of people like this. And even pornography, quickly, is a lot of unfortunate and angering images and situations with white men and black women. But yeah, it's very angering, and all the black speakers who speak about, who will pick a black person to speak about, they could instead pick a white person to speak about, like one of these individuals who are sexing our women, these white individuals. And then the other thing I wanted to mention, again, I am severely retarded, but I've also recognized that so is the rest of my people. And I don't know another word for sellout or treason. I don't know what the other word is. But we all do that. Like you mentioned before, like it's been mentioned, working at these jobs, the fact that white supremacy isn't ended, the fact that all these pornography sites are up and functioning, the fact that all our people, a lot of our people are being murdered, where you can understand the murder, like you, it's a quick murder. And then the fact that all people on earth are being killed before their time because of white people. The fact that none of that's changed means that we've all committed treason, we've all sold out, or whatever the words you want to use for that. I used to wonder, what happened to all the warriors? And I kept thinking about it, and I figured they were all murdered. There's no more warriors. That's too bad. The other thing I wanted to mention was the chemtrails. Again, they're going to continue. White people are going to continue to spray chemtrails to make the planet cold by reflecting the sun, using white clouds or whatever color clouds to reflect the rays of the sun so it doesn't reach Earth and touch white people's skin, or the rays of the sun doesn't reach Earth and warm the planet. In Louisville, they create domes. They create arches with their aircrafts, with the chemtrails are placed in a way to where when the light hits, when the light enters a certain depth of the atmosphere, once it gets close to Earth, it's being sent probably like to rural areas, you know, but it's not able to shine directly on you. It's getting reflected at an angle. But we need to stop. We need to stop white people from doing that. It's killing us. It's really killing us. Trying to think of the last thing that I was going to say. I can't think of it. So thank you.
I am certain it will come back to you. Much obliged, M. Han DC. Reading more important than watching television. We can and will solve this problem. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks, we have totally missed. If you have commentary you would like to share, lines should be open. Proceed. While the folks that have a hand up, I guess, get to a spot where they can speak or get their thoughts collected. I had mentioned, I think, last week maybe, in addition to the yoga retreat, Florida, December 28th to January 1st, I should be teaching next Sunday, so not tomorrow, but what is that, September 29th. I should be teaching. If you are in the Seattle area, it's 4 p.m. If you want to come to a pretty nice studio and take a yoga class, just 60 minutes. You can come hang out next Sunday, September 29. I should be teaching the next two Sundays. So that was the whole purpose for doing this, was to get more teaching practice. You can come take a yoga class. I will be teaching. Should be at least an hour of being safe, do a little yoga, maybe a little counter-racism next Sunday and the following Sunday. Looking forward to it. You can drop an email if you have questions or in the area and would like to come and participate. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you totally, if you have a hand up, proceed. I do see other folks who we've not heard from. I assume that they are getting themselves wherever they need to get to chat it up. We'll check in with them later. The other folks who dialed in, I guess I would say with the Justin Trudeau incident, I don't know if like black people in Canada, that's why I'll be eager to talk to Mr. Lawrence, Calvin Lawrence, in a few days, because he's lived in Canada. Like, I don't know if Mr. Trudeau, if black people there think that he's like not racist. Like, I don't know how he's perceived. Like, I've heard reports where he's supposed to be refined and endorsing these so-called white liberal policies. I'm not sure if he's fooled the black people that are there. I would have to listen a little bit more to hear, you know, talk to them to see what they think. But I'm pretty sure he's going to still win re-election. Like, it would be difficult. Seeing what I've seen with the Coon Man, it would be hard to think that this is going to be enough for a sitting prime minister to get fired, not re-elected. I find that, I don't live in Canada, but that just seems difficult to process and a system of race. I mean, they were talking about, if folks remember Rod Ford, do people remember he was mayor of Toronto not that long ago? I mean, he was mayor. Like, if people remember his antics, there was like videos of him doing drugs, crack, I believe, and making all kinds of racist, I mean, things that were way more explicitly racist and that people would be much more upset about than a so-called brown face or black face photograph from 20 years ago. He was doing like lifetime incorrect things and making racist remarks and that sort of thing. And he was the mayor. So it's difficult for me to imagine like a sizable number of whites who have probably dressed up like, you know, Curtis Blow or Drake or Chaka Khan themselves. It's hard for me to imagine like a sizable number of them saying, oh, yeah, you gotta get out of here. We're going to pick somebody else. Maybe so. We'll have to see. But I would think he's probably going to win re-election. We'll have to see. Coon man. Let's see. *61, if you have commentary. I don't know if the folks who we missed totally, I always feel peculiar at minimum when it's hands up, especially several hands up and folks that we've not heard from. But if those folks are still trying to, I guess, get to a spot where they can speak or collect their thoughts, the other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions to share, feel free as well.
Hi, Gus. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I actually meant to call in yesterday. I have a workplace situation kind of going on, and I know this is the compensatory call-in, so I don't want to, if it's better that I wait and call next week, I can, but I just wanted to kind of get some input.
Oh yeah, I'm always eager to try to be of assistance for workplace racism. That is always welcome.
Okay, all right, thank you. Well, I recently started a new job, and I'm about a month or so in. And I know one of the things you were saying about, you know, always being on time, or in fact, it's best to be early. The supervisor in my department is a non-white male, and I primarily work with other white males. And, you know, I've always been a, you know, very punctual person, and I continue, you know, to be. But the non-white supervisor, you know, told me that my colleagues would, you know, look at me with suspicion for being a little bit early at work. I've also noticed other comments from my white colleagues who are encouraging me to, you know, take long lunches. And I'm not sure if this is like a, you know, sabotage, but, you know, regardless of the information they give me, I continue to do my hour lunches and continue to come into work on time. But I'm noticing that it's being viewed with suspicion. And the last point I wanted to make is that in this office, it's only in terms of gender, it's myself and another non-white female, and the rest of my colleagues are men. And since being there, there has been a lot of sexual comments, not towards me or not to me, but comments that, you know, one really should not be saying in the workplace. But since I'm new, I don't really want to, you know, rock the boat. And the non-white supervisor hears, you know, what's going on and in a way somewhat participates in it. So I guess my question is that, you know, if we're, you know, I'm coming to work on time, I'm trying to do everything to prevent, you know, any issues, but even that seems to be viewed with suspicion. What would be your take on, you know, how to proceed in that workplace environment?
Workplace racism every Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, neutralizing workplace racism, our weekly broadcast where we devote the whole program to discussing this issue. This used to be
the exact time. It would be at this moment we would transition, and it would be workplace racism on the compensatory call-in. But now it has its own broadcast every Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. My thoughts, and other people can share their view as well, but my thought is you just started this job. That's always great because people don't really know you. You can start fresh with your counter-racist code. That is always great, as opposed to if you've been working there for like a year or 3 years and people already know you, and then you're trying to develop a counter-racist code, that can be more challenging. I would go right to what you said at the beginning. You listen to this program, some of the content apparently. We talked about being early. If you're supposed to be, you're scheduled to be at work at 8 o'clock, you plan to get there at 7:40. That's the time that you get there, and then you can do your ritual, 10 minutes in the car, get yourself together, go in and do great work. That's your schedule. That way, if something happens and you're running late, boom, bad day, you get there 20 minutes late, that means you arrive at 8. Hey. But you say, hey, I'm going to take, you know, that wacky advice. I'm going to get to work on time. What is this nigger doing? Showing up here early, that's we don't tolerate early arriving niggers around. As a matter of fact, why don't you take a long lunch? Yeah, go ahead and take a 3-hour lunch. Yeah, do that. That'll be great. We love that around here. That's what we like to see. Niggers that do not come in early and take 3-hour lunches. That is the key to success around here. Now, if that is their conduct and you've been here just, you know, a few days, literally, and you, as you said, are trying not to rock the boat, which is a metaphor, trying to not rock the boat, and that's how they're responding. That's what I mean when people say you attempting to use counter-racism even in the workplace, that that's going to provoke white people to mistreat you. No. White people mistreat non-white people just because they are dedicated to practicing racism. You can perform counter-racism or not perform counter-racism. They're going to mistreat you. It's just a matter of how you're going to respond or try to be preemptive about all of this. If you've concluded, oh yeah, unfortunately he's correct, they're going to mistreat us regardless. That being the case, I would continue to come to work early. And that lets me know, that lets you know, wow, they are observant. They notice, oh, she's coming in early, and they don't like it. I can't imagine in any other circumstance where you show up early, even if this was, you know, volunteer Frisbee League, and you showed up, our game was going to be at 6 p.m., and you showed up at 5:30. I can't imagine it being, what in the world? The Frisbee game doesn't start until 6. What are you doing showing up at 5:30? We don't like that. Get here at 6:05. What? In what context would that be said? That would be one. Then we get to the sexual misconduct, workplace racism. I think pretty regularly, my view is the great Walter Beach's metaphor, cut it at the knees, because that sexual misconduct, sexually inappropriate remarks, it escalates, meaning it will start with them just saying one thing, and then maybe another, and then some unwanted touching and that sort of thing. It just tends to, you know, how much can I get away with? How much can I? That sexual predators, that's what they do. They're tests. They test. They test. Oh, let's see what I can do to this nigger. Will she say anything? Let's see if I can do a little bit more. My view, and particularly you gave us the gender dynamics of your workplace, that it's mostly males, they like you, and I think maybe one other female in the workplace. That is totally unacceptable. You don't have to go and make an accusation, and I wouldn't encourage you to make an accusation, but I would definitely get that policy and procedure and look to see if they have a section about sexual misconduct in the workplace. I am sure they do, unless this is, you know, a really dangerous outfit and they don't have policy and procedure, but I would check the policy and procedure, highlight that paragraph, and then if they, there are many ways, if you all have any sort of meeting where the person or persons who are making these comments are present, you don't even have to name them. You can just say, you know,
what should be done if sexually inappropriate remarks are being made? And you could just say, for example, if something like this, and you, hey, I'm a new employee and I'm, you know, just want to understand how we get along. What's the procedure in the workplace? So if there's sexually inappropriate remarks, that's something that's been discussed a lot in the workplace. For example, somebody says blah, 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 and I would use exactly what one of the remarks was, exactly that. So this is said, what should be done to handle that? Because we want to make sure that we have a professional, safe, love that word, safe, working environment. That's one way that you can do it. It doesn't indict anybody, but the person who's been making the remarks, they hear that. That generally will get their attention and they will stop the behavior because they will know that you're serious about this is not going to be tolerated at all. And I would break my pen out and write down exactly what they say should be done. That's one way that you can handle it. You can go to the person directly. I think that's one that's been advocated. I think retired firefighter, he might be listening. He said that Walter Beach cut it at the knees. You can go to him directly, even if it's been 2 weeks since the person has said it, and just say, I do not feel safe. I don't think it's professional when you say things like blah, blah, blah. And I try to quote them exactly to what they said. I don't think it's professional and it makes me feel unsafe in the workplace. I would appreciate if you do not make those sort of remarks ever again in my presence in the workplace. And I would make it something where it's very explicit. So it's real direct that I do not think this is acceptable at all. And this is not going to be tolerated. And I'm letting you know that directly. If he, you know, gives a satisfactory response. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll never do that again. Oh, okay. No problem. Great. We can work together and just move forward constructively. It should be resolved. And if it happens again, then you can go to a more powerful white person. And I would date stamp it too. I would go tell him verbally and I would put that in my workplace journal that I went and had this conversation. This is what I said. This is the date and time. Boom. And then if it comes up again, then I would go to a more powerful white person and I would let them know that we already had one conversation and now this behavior is continuing. But those are at least two ways that you can deal with it. I would look at the policy and procedure to see if they have something about sexual misconduct there. I would highlight those pages and then pick a strategy and go to work. Does that seem reasonable?
Yes. All of what you're saying seems very reasonable. And, you know, I've called before, and I was the person who, you know, I got a transfer to another department. And in terms of the department, you know, it's not a bad department. However, it's the supervisor, you know, he's a black male. He's African American. He kind of condones this, and it seems like the office culture is extremely laid back. You know, I've heard him make comments about, well, I'm going to go and browse the internet for a few hours, or I'm going to go and do this, or I'm going to go take an hour and a half lunch. So it's a lot of blatant disregard, and I believe part of the issue is because the supervisor condones that type of behavior. Having someone who comes in to work on time or a little bit early and somebody who follows the policy and procedure, I think is unsettling to him. And I think, you know, I'm being observed, but I'm going to start documenting and, you know, say something about the sexual comments, because these comments are being said, you know, and the supervisor is right there. So he hears it. It's kind of, you know, in a group, and it's a very small office. So it's not like I could go to my supervisor and say, hey, this is making me uncomfortable, because he is, you know, he partakes in it as well whenever the white colleagues, you know, say things that are inappropriate. So I think I just need to, you know, document and, you know, possibly at some point soon, you know, escalate it to someone, you know, higher. Because normally you would go to your supervisor, but your supervisor is the one that's kind of condoning it and, you know, making, you know, those kinds of comments as well.
Well, we've had many conversations about, you know, the non-white supervisors and who is really in charge in a system of racism, white supremacy. I'm sure the whites understand that better than others in that work environment. I guess it would just, yeah, I mean, going to a more powerful white person, that definitely is an option. And going with the policy and procedure in hand to get this remedy, that's great. And not even making an accusation, just inappropriate comments are being made. This needs to be stopped. And it seems to be a culture-wide thing where these sort of comments are made and condoned to get this addressed so that we can have a safe, emphasize that word, safe, professional work environment. I guess folks can, if other people have any thoughts about how they would deal with this, would you, well, she says more than one person. If it's more than one person, it might be best to just go to a more powerful white person. I was thinking if it's just one person, even one white person, you can try addressing it with them directly to see if that solves it. But if it's widespread, if it's multiple folks, then it might be best to just go to a more powerful white person and have them address it as a cultural widespread issue. Maybe they can have training. Did any other folks have suggestions about what would be the best way to the, I guess the main component is the sexual remarks, but then also keeping in mind that she is under surveillance and her coming to work early is viewed as suspicious, niggardly behavior.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call again. I appreciate her inquiry. I'm getting ready to start a job, and part of the what I've done is, you know, beat the handbook. It says, you know, so I went through it, and I would suggest definitely going through it again. My particular handbook says you can only be at work at the time you're scheduled to be at work, which is weird because I'm supposed to be a faculty member, and sometimes you like to get there early to prepare, and you have to stay late to finish up. So I'm going to ask about that tomorrow. Monday when I officially go, and I will look at that, and I will ask, well, when is the earliest you can enter the building? Things like that, because if you're getting there too early, I mean, you're obviously not there too early. I don't hear you have to open the door with a key or something like that. So if the building is open, when is the earliest I can, you know, I can arrive at work? With the sexual harassment, I would, like he said, I would address that right away. It should be in, it should be policy. If there's not a policy about it, that's almost a county violation for auditors to put stuff like that. That's a big no-no. That should be there. If it's not there, I guess you have to go the legal route. And also, I would think about seeing how it also affects your mental health, because that could be a workers' comp claim as well, because these people are affecting your mental health. So I would look into that as well, because something like that over and over again, I think personally that would affect my mental health and my ability to perform. So I would look into that as well. But it sounds like you're all doing a lot of the right things, going to work on time. And again, with the long lunches, you know, just how long can a person eat? 3 hours is a long time to eat lunch. I mean, I was just asking like that. I mean, what possibly could I eat in 3 hours? And that's all. Thank you.
Much obliged. Policy and procedure. Policy and procedure. That is not just an idle recommendation. Read it, review it, highlight if needed. Do we have any other suggestions for how you would deal with this workplace racism dilemma, the sexual terrorism component, and or the suspicion about you coming to work early?
Hello?
Yes. Irie, yes, ma'am.
Yes, I'm putting my phone over. Hello, can you hear me?
Your volume is fluctuating a little bit. It was there, and then it was not there, so try again.
Okay, hello?
That's better.
Okay, so as far as the early arrival and people saying it's suspicious, personally, I would disregard it as some type of psychological intimidation, because if you haven't been officially cited, or whatever the word is for, you know, the corporate workplace or wherever you're at, if no one's come to you with a report or some type of something in writing, then it sounds like people practicing racism, trying to get into your head to make you feel guilty because they're not able to do what you're able to do. And it could be some jealousy as well. Here you are, you're outshining not only your counterparts, but the, in my opinion, confused black male supervisor who is, in a sense, catering to the racism of lower white employees. So I wouldn't say anything about it. No, until someone comes to you in writing, I, in one ear and out the other metaphor, but that's what I would do. I would dump it. And in regard to mental health, if it does eventually take, it does make you get to a point where you need to, you think you have a claim, you have to substantiate it first. You have to start going to counseling, and you have to have medical records of you going to someone and seeing someone for counseling or whatever it is, some type of therapy for managing the stress and, you know, the specific things at work. And you can't mention anything else. You can only mention the stuff going on at work. And I'm saying it from experience because I had to do that myself. And then later on, if you end up leaving or you have a workers' comp claim, then you really will have a legal claim because you'd have substantiated it with, you know, doctor's records. And, yeah, I would try to seek the higher, you know, just in any situation, there's someone higher than the person that's directly over you. So, you know, follow the chain of command. Say, hey, you know, I'm having these issues. I've read the policy and procedure, and it's contradictory to the way we're supposed to conduct ourselves or proceed at work. How do you advise me to, you know, to go forward? And if there's no answer, you just keep going up the chain and then maybe even CC the people under the person that you're talking to now. So they see, okay, she's not afraid to escalate this. She's letting me know on this email that she's escalating it as well. And perhaps there'll be some type of remedy from there. And of course, if not, you know, you escalate legally with some type of representation. But out of sight, out of mind for that gossip, because it's gossip about you coming to work early and it's suspicious. It sounds like jealousy to me.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And one of the points that what you said that really stuck out is that it's kind of like a psychological intimidation, which I never thought of it that way, because most people would be you know, happy to have someone, you know, that they could rely on. So, you know, I'm not sure if they're trying to get me to kind of, you know, let loose, but, you know, I know as soon as, you know, I take a hour and a half lunch or do what they're doing, you know, I'm going to be the one, you know, written up. But I'm just going to, you know, be careful and be aware of my, you know, mental health and how, you know, what's going on is affecting me.
Much obliged. Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Yeah, it sounds like a situation where the co-workers are not doing the right thing, and based off of their actions, they want you also, you know, you're making them look bad. Or even in, like, the case of police where you have dirty cops, they don't trust the cops that aren't dirty, you know, because, you know, you have to have the dirt on you too. You know, you have take an hour and a half lunch. You know, they don't feel comfortable with you following the rules and them totally not following. So they're applying that sort of peer pressure, like high schoolish type peer pressure. You know, yeah, you do it too. I didn't catch what was the sexual misconduct in the context of how it was presented to you.
Can you repeat that last part? I couldn't quite hear you. I just
wanted to know, what did they do to you that it made you feel like you're being sexually harassed?
They're not necessarily doing anything to me
physically or like touching me, but a lot of the conversations, there's a lot of sexual talk, you know, going on, you know, in front of me, like very inappropriate things. I don't want to go into, you know, like detail, but it's just, it's the commentary. It's the conversations they're having, a conversation you really should not, you know, have, you know, at work. So it's not so much them saying it, you know, towards me, but what they are saying is, you know, it's really, really inappropriate.
Gotcha. So I think white people have the phrase, they coined for that now, called locker room talk. So, yeah, I would go to my immediate supervisor in that case, and maybe either in email form or in a way where I speak to him, and then I immediately go and, you know, as per our conversation type email, just to let it, you know, have that record. I don't think I would go up the ladder to the highest, you know, white supremacist yet, because this is going to be presented as, oh, we were just, you know, talking, and, you know, like Gus said, we're going to have a seminar and have someone come in and talk about sexual harassment, or like they do at my job, you have to take these little quizzes that pop up on your email every such and such. You have a few days to take it, and it's about sexual harassment. So I think the first step would be to let the supervisor know that you feel uncomfortable with that type of conversation taking place. And then now, if he does nothing about it, like Gus said, you know, now you go to the next step. But I wouldn't go too high up immediately.
Yeah, and I guess
especially if you like the job and you feel like this is a job you want to have, then you don't want people to totally alienate you because someone got fired, or, you know, it's presented to them like you're the problem.
Right, right. And I guess it would be easier, I guess, if, you know, the comments and the things that were being said, they say it in front of the supervisor. So the supervisor really doesn't see it as it being anything wrong with it. But, you know, I guess you're right. If I, you know, do escalate it too soon, then they usually kind of find a way to turn it back around, you know, on me. But then if I go to the supervisor, you know, he's there when the conversations, whenever this is happening, and he's participating in it. So he obviously doesn't see it as being inappropriate. So it's kind of a bit of a difficult situation, but I'll have to figure out a way to kind of, you know, navigate it. And I haven't been documenting, you know, thus far, but that's something I'm, you know, going to have to start doing, so I'll be able to, you know, specify, you know, dates and times when the issues, you know, occurred.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. I'm on DC.
Yes, sir. So, suggestion. I would state out loud in front of the female employee, the other female employee, and in front of the men. So when all of you are together, I would make it very plain and simple that as a woman, I am uncomfortable with sexual conversation. I have a husband, a boyfriend, whatever it is. I don't feel comfortable. Do not do this in my presence or at the workplace. You have to be specific and direct, and it would be best if you did it, I think, if you did it in the presence of the other woman so that you have an advocate, even if she finds some of the males attractive, and even if she may not fully agree with you, you're both women. You both have the same situations, the same issues. She will advocate for you and defend you. All the men will feel like they're being, I guess you could say, attacked, or they feel like they're being addressed. They know they're being addressed. And then so you would have another advocate in the woman. But you have to say it to them so that they are very clear that this behavior is inappropriate. And also, everybody wants sex. So I don't even understand why women and men work together in this quote-unquote workplace or in a building. It doesn't make sense to me. I mean, sex is fine, but in a workplace, it makes it an environment to where, I mean, every workplace I've been at, there's inappropriate comments. And it's usually the men making sexual comments. But the reason you even make a sexual comment to where another person can hear you is because you want that comment to influence that person. Yeah. So they're trying to prep you, or the men are trying to get you ready for sex. But again, this is what people and living things do. But yeah, I don't think it's appropriate for men and women to work together in a workplace. And maybe I'm just confused. But okay, thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. Did we have any folks that we missed totally who had a comment that they wanted to make sure they get in, because we have about 8 minutes or so left in the broadcast? Any folks we missed totally?
Never heard.
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. We don't have a lot to say. I'm trying to make it quick. Got 9 minutes. Got to get this in at 5. But anyway, so I think white people are conditioning us to hate Jay-Z, and I think that they're probably planning to take his money, maybe give him some criminal charges or something like that. Accomplice, there's been talk about him being an accomplice. I think that's illogical, because he has no power. He has no power to, you know, practice racism. So I don't see how he can, you know, be an accomplice. And also, just even with that term, first of all, it's name calling. With that term, you're getting very close to calling victims racist by calling them accomplices and things of that nature, and holding us responsible for white people's actions. And also, I think it's just even using those terms and talking about people like that is really just making excuses for our own participation. Because as was said a long time ago, even the people who were victims of slavery a long time ago, they could have just committed suicide and we could do the same thing. But we choose to live and, you know, do what we do that, you know, assists races rather than commit suicide. So we don't have any room to be calling anybody accomplices, sellouts, or any of that. And also, you can't be an accomplice and a victim at the same time. There are even duress and necessity defenses for things like that. And if there was any type of situation that was under duress or under necessity, it would be just non-white people in a system of white supremacy. I mean, you know, Jay-Z is a victim of racism in a lot of ways, and one of the ways is just deprivation of resources. I mean, he came into the music industry very poor, as a lot of, you know, black people did, because of, you know, white people. Also, it was stated that it's possible that they could have threatened him, you know, to sign up with the NFL and all of that, that they could have threatened him to harm Beyonce. But I think before they would threaten to harm her, they would threaten to harm his child. And also in terms of, like, encouraging name-calling, I never hear, you know, people encouraging name-calling against women. It's always men when they're supposedly helping white people or whatever the case may be. And you hear a lot of this stuff, like, from people who act like what is known as feminists. But I would say that if you are a black woman and you do anything less than honor black men, there's nothing feminine about you. And if anything, you should be suspected as a homosexual. And the last couple of things I wanted to say is that just even the term sellout, it really suggests that somebody owes you something, that they owe you some type of loyalty or to treat you a certain way because they look like you. And that's completely illogical. And the reason I would say that it suggests that they owe you something is because I don't hear that term being applied to, let's say, other non-white people when they may do something to so-called help a racist, to harm another black person or whatever. You only hear that term sellout when they're supposedly helping white people to harm people who look like you. But, you know, non-white is non-white. So it's like this idea that, you know, other black people owe you something because they look like you and they should treat you a certain way because of that. It's just that's not logical. They're not your family members. They don't know you. None of that. And that was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus. And greetings to everyone if I didn't greet everyone. And I hope everybody has as good a weekend as they can have. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Ivy. Anybody that we missed totally?
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I just wanted to share two quick things. I just got home from my brother's. He had a wedding today, an attempted wedding. I guess that's the codified term for it. But I just wanted to share something really quick. Yesterday at the rehearsal, the grandmother of my brother's now attempted wife, she, you know, we were getting acquainted or whatever, and she said she was working. We were catching up. She said she was working at this place, and she says, you know, I'm hearing these conversations too, and it's like they're talking almost as though that I'm not there. Basically, was saying that, you know, the white people at her job are speaking, practicing racism, basically. And she catches them standing in front of her, whatever the comments are. But when you're around confused black people, you're prone to hear language like this. So she says she's hearing her coworkers say things like she is a black person, isn't around. So I just wanted to share that one. And she was kind of getting into not really an argument with the daughter, which is the mother. And she was saying, well, that's just your personal opinion, because it seemed like she was getting upset at the service that we were getting at the place. So I just wanted to report that. I might not have been as clear on what I'm saying, but those were just two incidents of the grandmother being focused, trying to, as Mr. Fuller says, find their way, or find, you know, the victim finding their way to understanding, or trying to set focus on getting a clear understanding of what it means to be white. Yeah, I wanted to share that because she was focusing on how they were bringing cups to them for the orders for the food that they were getting, and other people were getting glasses. So I was very, I wouldn't say happy, but I was interested to see that another black person that close to me was focusing on racism other than the black people that I on a regular basis speak to. So I just wanted to report those two observations, and that'll be it. Thank you, sir.
Much obliged. Always great to see black people being more scientific, more alert, aware of racism, white supremacy, and in detail. What does that mean? Something we try to encourage on this here broadcast. Congratulations to your brother, their attempted marriage. Hope they can partnership and get some counter-racism in there. Hopefully that'll, you know, help things stay together in a constructive manner. But congratulations. Shame that a day that's supposed to be about that, and instead we got to switch and have our attention on racism. That's why this problem has to be solved immediately. We've done our 3 hours. We had someone wrote in about sexual misconduct in the workplace yesterday. Neutralizing Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific on Fridays. You can always email if you have questions, suggestions, thoughts. But yeah, we had a listener. She wrote in and she said, in fact, she was going to leave her job because she had white
at least one white male, and it may have been more, but he was just coming and like loitering in her area when he had no discernible task or reason for being there. And it would be like he's just kind of trying to manufacture incidents where they can have contact or where he can talk to her or brush into her. And she felt that there was something sexual about this, sexually predatory about his behavior. And she said that she was going to go ahead and leave the job. Thought it was serious. And yeah, was eager to get feedback about that yesterday. But we'll return to that perhaps this coming Friday for workplace racism. Again, drop an email. The yoga retreat in Florida extended the deadline just to make sure we nab all of the last minute folks. If they need any additional information, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Deposits Monday, $475 by Monday. Much obliged. We'll do it up December 28th to January 1 in Florida. If you'd like to take a class before then, if you're in the Seattle area, next Sunday and the Sunday afterwards, I will be teaching. If you want to come take an hour class, drop me an email. Can give you all of the info. With that, much obliged to everyone who participated. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Check the Facebook page, Black Talk Radio Network, for the coming broadcast. Calvin Lawrence, listeners in Canada. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's do all that we can to preserve our brain computers so that we can come up with solutions to the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact, let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. Let's make certain we are not on the phone if we are going to be driving. Again, just trying to do all that we can to keep ourselves as safe as possible under extraordinarily dangerous circumstances. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.